the phallus, the obelisk, with a nice red bow tied around the base, which represented the testes. You know what he was saying to you? Are there any children in here? He was laughing at you. And so was every other member of the Illuminati. He was a highly degreed member of the Sovereign and Military Order of the Knights of Malta, which was taken over in the Peasants' Revolt in England by the Knights Templars, who had sworn revenge upon the old Hospitallers of St. John's, which later became the Knights of Malta, because of their role in the suppression of the Templars.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On Friday, the 12th of March, 2021, I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also Lib Dem councillor for Knoll and Bristol City Council Lib Dem group leader Gary Hopkins. In the second part, we have another look at the traitor king, Edward Windsor, and his timeline of treachery with an author who's written all about that. And she has looked into some of the records, both in Spain and in Russia, about the diplomatic blunders, if you can call them that, or the treachery of Edward VIII before the Second World War and during the Second World War, and him leading to the Blitz in the UK, and exactly how he did that, a complete timeline. We're going to go through that in the second part. This is really because of the echoes, in some ways, with the Edward and Mrs. Simpson case, the absolute crisis going on within the royal family back then, and Meghan Markle and Harry. Now, I wonder whether you think there's any real comparison between the two. So that's one of the biggies for the second part. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays on the PRSC stream, and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioquk.com too. So I'd just like to start by introducing our main guest, really, for the first part. That's Councillor Gary Hopkins. Are you still group leader for the Lib Dems, Gary?
I certainly am, yes.
How would you set apart the Lib Dems as a political policy group from the Tories, the Greens and Labour on the council? What's your main sort of ideological difference as you see it?
Well, I think our first main point that the public see is community, in terms of working with residents in our area, trying to get them involved in things, trying to allow them to make decisions. But it's one of the reasons why we've got so much problem with the existing administration and previous one to some extent as well with the mayor, because all semblance of community decision making and community involvement, the mayor's trying to cut that out completely, and it's very concerning. If you cut people off from involvement in the community in the way that the council's actually run, it's actually very negative.
Now, 2012, I think it was, when we had went over to the mayor system, and we had George Ferguson as the mayor, and then we had obviously Marvin Rees taking over, and he's managed to get an extra year because they cancelled the elections on him, so he's the unelected mayor for a year. Can you just give us an idea of the way that the communities were involved before that? Because it was actually a Lib Dem administration, wasn't it?
For most of the time, although we did have a year or so in the few years before the mayor when we had a minority Labour administration as well. But I think what was different about things then was that all parties had greater or lesser influence, and their views were actually heard, whereas at the moment that doesn't happen at all. The public in 10 cities were offered the chance to vote to have an executive mayor, and 9 of them had the good sense to say no. And in Bristol, there was, you know, a lot of promises with regard to extra money, extra resources, extra decision making locally. And by a very narrow margin, the Tories managed to persuade people across, well, in their parts of Bristol, to vote for the job. And was, you know, in most of these most people stayed at home and they thought this has got nothing to do with us. So we actually had 13% of the electorate defeating 12% of the electorate in different parts of town. And then, you know, we got the first mayor. When we got to the end of his term, he was less popular than he had been at the beginning. And people voted for the person most likely to beat him. And now they seem to be regretting having done that. One interesting part was that when the Tories originally invented this system, there was no right of recall or reverse at all. So Bristol would have been the only place in Britain with no right to actually remove the post mayor, because in lots of towns and cities, there has been a reversal. And we had to go up to Parliament and put a motion through, an amendment through Parliament, to actually get that right for Bristolians to have a referendum to reverse the position, which they will be able to do from next year.
Well, anyway, things are moving, aren't they? Because next week we've got a discussion at full council here in Bristol about the future of the mayor. What's happening and when?
Well, next Tuesday at 6 o'clock full council, I've got a motion down, which I know will be pretty widely supported. Don't know the final outcome yet, but basically it says that we should call the referendum in a year's time and give people, Bristolians, the choice as to whether they carry on with the mayor system or whether they go back to the system that was there before, where you had a leader who was answerable to the councillors in the council house. The problem at the moment is that the mayor isn't answerable to anybody, even his own party. So basically, there's a complete disconnect between the mayor and the public.
Well, look, you've said the mayor's not answerable to his own party, but over what issues have you found Labour councillors actually splitting away from the official party line?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult for them to actually go against the party line, because the whipping is very severe. I mean, we know that the couple who actually voted against the party line in the budget were actually expelled from the party or told to apologise, or they would be expelled from the party, and I think they declined the offer. We had the arena where basically we know the majority of Labour councillors were actually with us and felt that it should have gone ahead. They've been kept in the dark on so many things as well, with regard to Bristol Energy Company, for example. It'd been very difficult to find out what was actually going on there. And that's part of the problem, that the suppression of information is very, very concerning.
And I believe, is it Joe Sargent, one of the councillors, has resigned or been sacked? One of the Labour ones?
Yeah, she refused to apologise for voting with her conscience. It was an issue I actually agreed with her on, in that, because there was an election coming up, they decided not to put the standard rent rise in for council tenants, which would have gone to about £1 a week, and a lot of it would have been covered by central government benefits. But they thought it would be might lose them some votes. But the problem is, unless you actually have money coming in, you can't repair and build new council houses. And with a small amount of extra money that would have been coming in, some of it coming from central government, there would have been the ability to borrow a lot more money. It's one of the reasons why I think that Paul Smith left before he was a housing executive member. And basically, I think he just got fed up not being able to go on and do the job he needed to do.
Okay, so does the Labour group actually have a majority on Bristol City Council anymore?
No. We're not certain what's happened to Bowden Jones, but certainly they had two councillors who walked away previously. They've had Joe Sargent, who's left. Of course, there was a defection from them to us with Sultan Khan, who's joined us, our party. So they've lost at least four councillors since the election. And some of the ones that are still nominally there aren't exactly full of enthusiasm for the administration.
No.
In fact, I think it's councillors are not standing again.
Martin Summers, you're a Labour Party member. It does sound as if Marvin Rees, the Mayor's attempts to rein his councillors in to sort of get them to conform to his policies, support the things that he's doing, there's a bit of pushback. Now, obviously, there are some councillors who are going along with this, but there are others who are walking away.
Well, it's an inherently contradictory situation created by having a directly elected mayor and directly elected councillors who can't overrule the mayor. And it's to do with the design of the system, which is a non-design system. I mean, Gary will know that I'm not a great fan of having elected mayors, never have been. But of course, the obvious point to point out is that the Liberal Democrats were in coalition at national level with the Tories when all of this came through.
Yeah, how do you answer that, Gary?
I answer it in that our MPs were very new in at the time, and they were not popular with the party in general for not kicking up more of a fuss against this directly elected mayor thing. But at least there was a referendum, and in 9 cases out of 10, cities actually said no. I think in Bristol, the Evening Post was actually quite influential in this, and that they managed to create an impression that everything was chaos. Well, no system is ever perfect, and people voted for to have a mayor to rescue the city.
Well, I remember it very well back in 2012, I think it was, that even the chair of the National Union of Journalists branch in Bristol, Christina Zaba, appeared on a large sort of half anyway of a centre page spread on the Bristol Post saying what a wonderful idea this was going to be. And I thought that was a little bit cheeky because she's okay to speak as her own off her own bat as an individual, but it certainly didn't represent what most of the journalists in the city thought. But anyway, there's loads of other stuff going on, Gary, isn't there? There's also this gap in pay. Now, this is something which, you know, Labour authorities have really got to keep a very, very close eye on, because it's something that is seen as a massive vote winner, the idea of inequality in society, that there are some people with hardly anything and others with a lot, that there's a big advantage to sorry, we've just lost Gary there. I'll just try and bring him back. That we've lost
Hello.
Yeah, sorry Gary, we lost you for a second there. A big pay gap. This is not good for a Labour administration to be seen to have a big gap between the richest and the poorest council employees, even. This is something that Marvin Rees has got direct control over, these salaries, and yet it seems that there's quite a big gap there.
Well, I mean, the top earners are getting more, and the lower earners, I mean, this is quite a shocking thing. They're actually shifting out a lot of the clearing and security staff from Bristol City Council off to Bristol Waste Company. It's basically they're going to be badly treated, and they know it, and all unions are kicking up a stink about it, very understandably, because one of the, the manager for Bristol Waste for some years ago was a council employee, and she was actually fired out, unfairly dismissed. So they've seen that happening to their boss, and I can see the same thing might happen to them if they're actually shifted across. There's a huge dishonesty as well about the pay policy statement, because the biggest earners in council are actually the consultants, some of them who have been there for a long, long time.
Okay, well, look, tell us about this guy Colin Moulton then, because he's almost like a sort of Mandelson character, a minister without portfolio sort of guy, although he's actually not, you know, a politician, he's a council officer, but he's getting involved with all of these, what you might call dodgy deals, the property deals, the speculative deals, like the one down at Temple Island and, what they call Western Harbour, what the rest of the city calls Hot Wells.
Yeah, well, he's technically not a council officer because he's not. He's paid as a consultant. And basically, he was actually for quite a while in charge of the growth and regeneration director of the council. See, he was a senior manager for the council, but he wasn't actually on the pay books. He was a consultant. Well, eventually, there was so many many people on the HR committee kicked off about that, that he had to be moved out. Now, what amazed us after that was that he was involved in the recruitment of his replacement, Mr. Peacock. He used to work for the Regional Non-Development Agency, and he's been put in place instead of him. And one of the first things that Mr. Peacock actually did was issue contracts to Mr. Moulton to carry on working on various schemes for the council. So he's carried on a permanent basis, been there effectively for 4 years, and enormous pay, and it doesn't even appear on the council payments.
Well, this sounds extremely dodgy. How much is he on?
Last check was £1,450 a day.
£1,450
a day.
For 4 years?
Yeah.
Good God. So this is council taxpayers' money paying for this. Okay, Martin, this sounds to me as if, you know, the whole process of employing council officers in the proper way, which can be managed by council committees and by councillors, is the Mayor, Marvin Rees, has just run coach and horses through it.
Well, all he's doing is using the powers that are given to him under the Tory-designed mayoral system. And the mayoral system was designed so that speculators, you know, they've pulled back the central government grant to local authorities, and it's done in a totally partisan way, so that the cuts have been far the heaviest cuts in the country have been in Merseyside, and the smallest cuts, in fact slight increases in central government funding, have gone to East Dorset, which is the richest place in the country. And then, of course, the system then forces the mayors in the major conurbations to engage in speculative activities and so on in order to carry on trying to get re-elected on the basis of keeping council services and not cutting them. And of course, Marvin, to my mind's main fault has been to go along with this and the whole illusion that the mayor is some kind of entrepreneurial leader of new ideas for Bristol, when in actual fact, as a Labour mayor or somebody like Ken Livingstone running the GLC in the 1980s, you just stand up to central government as far as you can, and you have to tell the people who vote for you that it's very limited things you can do, because ultimately the centralised state in Britain requires change at national level, and both the Greens and the Liberal Democrats peddle the delusion that community politics is going to change the situation. And, of course, it can't.
Well, Marvin Rees, the Labour Mayor of Bristol, has already intimated that he thinks he may not win a second term when we have the elections in May, Gary. What's the actual situation for Lib Dems and other groups when it comes to knocking door to door? Because we've got COVID restrictions, haven't we?
It has been very difficult to actually campaign, and in actual fact our normal sort of communication of keeping on speaking to people all through the year has been that much more difficult. The shackles are off for the last 6 or 8 weeks of the campaign, and basically we will be able to communicate there, but I mean some of us are still sort of being a bit cautious about going on and knocking on too many doors. We're expecting that Labour will lose seats, and we're not yet certain, because we don't have enough data as to exactly who they're going to lose them to in terms of the mayoral result. It's anybody's result at the moment. The only people who can't win are the Greens. But, you know, our stance of getting rid of the mayor has been very popular, because majority of Bristolians want to get rid of the mayor's system.
Okay, Yeah, but hang on, because you're saying the Greens don't really stand a chance, but surely most of these Labour voters, even if they are disillusioned with the Blairite Marvin Rees, the mayor, who seems to be more wedded to big business and speculators and developers than he does to the working people, we've got this guy Sandy Hall Rutherford standing for the Greens. A lot of those Labour voters are going to be voting for Sandy, aren't they? Their natural direction is going to be towards another left-wing party rather than the Lib Dems, Gary, who they see as having been in bed quite recently in central government with the Conservatives.
Well, I think that you've got to look at different parts of town. In some of the central Greens have got a few votes. As soon as you get a distance out from the centre, hardly anybody votes for them. And basically, therefore, no chance of actually taking control of the city council. You know, in most wards, you know, that are bang in the centre, if they get 5 or 10% of the vote, it's quite an event.
Yeah, but they don't need those councillors. What I'm saying is all they need is a mayor. They don't need the councillors. If Sandy manages to become the mayor, all the councillors are almost irrelevant, as you are now. I mean, this is one of the problems. The mayor has made the councillors barely relevant when it comes to making, you know, all the big decisions, the spending decisions, the policy-making decisions in the city.
Yeah, well, I'll just explain to you that there's no way that the Greens can actually win because they don't have support across the city.
Yeah.
They have it in central parts, but, you know, the central parts aren't the whole city. You've got to be able to perform in a number of different areas. Now, in a normal election, it would be quite difficult for us to win. But because the mayor's so unpopular, and we're stating that, you know, our main theme at the moment is get rid of the position of mayor, that's actually attracted us lots of supporters that we wouldn't normally have.
Yeah, but I mean, how can you have, your candidate, Caroline Gooch, I think it is, she's standing to abolish her own position.
Yes.
Well, it just sounds absurd. It sounds absurd, Gary.
The thing is that you've got to put what people want, what's right for Bristol, before your own personal ambition. And I'm afraid we've had two mayors now. And the first thing is their ego. You've got to beat them down with a stick. And basically, you know, they're looking after their own interests rather than looking after the interests of Bristol. And that's inherent in having the mayor's system because they've got huge amounts of power at their disposal, all the council resources. And Marvin is just using it to try and get himself re-elected rather than thinking about what is best for the city.
Well, I notice also the just this week, a load of adverts popping up, last weekend I think it was, on the Bristol Post website, big pictures of Marvin Rees on both sides. I assume these adverts have been paid for out of council taxpayers' money.
Some of them are, yes. I mean, the Labour Party got a fair amount of money as well. Sometimes they pay for that. But, I mean, the PR department is actually going absolutely bananas at the moment. Talking about all sorts of schemes which may or may not happen, but they're being put out as if they're definitely going to happen. I mean, the nonsense about the rapid transit system, I mean, you know, where's he going to find £5 billion from? It's all a load of nonsense.
Well, I think if Marvin were here, and of course Marvin refuses to take phone calls, he won't reply to my requests for interviews, neither will Sandy Hall Rutherford, the Green candidate, so it would be lovely to get his opinion, but we can't do that, I'm afraid, dear listeners. But I'm sure Marvin would say that you know, this is something which is going to be done through private investment. He's going to be brokering private investment deals to get these public transport infrastructure in there.
Well, we've seen his brilliance with private investment, haven't we, with Bristol Energy? An absolute disaster. Nearly £60 million down the drain. There's going to be all sorts of organisations coming along. We were told with the City Leap.
Yeah, but he was saddled, hang on, because he was saddled with that debt after it had been your administration and George Ferguson that got the whole Bristol Energy thing started before he was in power.
Oh, don't believe the bullshit. Basically, we said we talked about the possibility when circumstances were entirely different, setting up an energy company which is entirely different to the model which eventually George set up. He set it up about a year before leaving office, and he actually spent about £4 or 5 million on it. He might have had rose tinted glasses, but that's what he was responsible for. We were not responsible for one penny of spending on that at all. And then basically Marvin had a huge great launch. What a wonderful thing this energy company was. Lost £50 million and then he looked around for somebody to blame. And then he went through rose tinted glasses to panic and indecision, followed by actual cover-up, where he actually, long after he knew that there was no chance of it actually ever making a profit, he kept it going to try and get past the 2020 elections. because he couldn't keep it going long enough to get past the 2021 election. So the stuff has gradually come out, but there's still quite a few details that the public are not fully aware of.
Well, would you like to just share those with us, Carrie? Because I know it's at least £50 million of public money that was poured down the drain there. I wonder whose pockets it's ended up in.
Well, I mean, there are reports, which I've seen bits of, which I'm under threat of legal action if I disclose. But I can tell you, as an example, that the chief executive of the company was described by the auditors as actually having no accountability at all.
Well, that's it. I mean, an audit report should be quite okay to share that sort of thing. I would have thought that's what auditors are for, isn't it, in the public sphere?
Well, that was a private report that was done, was kept under wraps. Since that time, of course, the independent auditors, as part of their routine job, were actually encouraged by opposition parties to have a good look at personal energy. And their damning report on the governance was is absolutely staggering. They came up with a 12-point plan saying that these 12 points needed to be actioned. Otherwise, it was just going to be happening again and again. And we actually passed that. I actually put a motion down the council saying that the council must adopt those recommendations from the independent auditor, and a temporary committee be set up to make certain that they are actually actioned. And do you know what? They haven't actually set the committee up yet, despite a unanimous vote in council to set it up and to get on with the job, and they haven't done it.
Martin, it sounds to me like Bristol City Council under Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, is just cocking a snook at democracy and legality.
Well, I'm not going to defend Marvin. Marvin's got to defend himself. But, you know, these are inherent in the setup. And, you know, basically, this setup is not really, as Gary, I'm sure, will agree, is not an ideal setup. The only thing I could say about the mayoral system, which I do agree with, is that there's a transfer vote. And it's going to be very interesting to see, because, of course, Marvin last time won on the first round. He didn't need transfer votes. It may be that the transfer votes this time are going to be quite significant. And that then gives you a vision of how people's mood is moving, both within Bristol and elsewhere. Because, of course, I'm afraid, unluckily for Gary and others, is that lots of people don't vote in local elections. The only people who do are the political junkies, the 30 to 40% who actually pay attention, and they tend to vote on tribal lines because that's why they're participating, and it'll all be to do with what's happening in the national scene. And I'm afraid a lot of local politicians get frustrated with that because they think local politics should be about local issues. But I'm afraid, I mean, things like universal credit and COVID are far more important to people than the minutiae of running the city.
Gary?
Well, yeah, I mean, the national things do affect local voting patterns. And we're pretty certain this time that although the government made a fair old mess of handling COVID situation for most last year, they've done pretty well with regard to the vaccines and the rollout on that. They seem to finally learn what to do. And that's produced a huge bounce in Conservative Party popularity. So, you know, we've got to watch and see the seats, where that makes a difference in Bristol City Council. So if you put the fact that the Labour mayor is personally staggeringly unpopular, and that the, there's this bounce for the Conservative Party, there's a national stuff that's happening just at the moment, then you've got to think, is Marvin... we think he should do, but I think this is certainly a very big question mark as to whether he's going to win.
All right, so looking at the PR side of things, as I sometimes like to do, Gary, I mean, this is obviously one of the things that big business counts on in order to win its sales and profits and things like that. And we've seen increasingly governments, local government, etc., also trying to copy those policies, you know, to sort of bounce people into voting for them rather than bouncing, you know, people into buying a particular kind of washing powder or something. But with, in terms of PR, in a run-up to an election, is the incumbent Labour Mayor Marvin Rees, is he allowed to use the council PR facilities to campaign in his election?
Well, he would say, of course, and it's very difficult to prove completely differently, that he's boosting Bristol City Council and the way that the city looks. He's doing it for the image of the city. And, of course, that's what George claimed as well. It's pretty blatant, but legally proving that he's spending money on his own election campaign is actually quite difficult to do. Now, people in the know can see what's going on. What the public actually see are lots of press releases coming out saying wonderful things are going to be happening.
Okay, so what about the what about all this public transport they're about to get? Because I can't seem to remember back 5 years ago when we had the previous mayoral elections, we had a whole load of promises about an underground from Marvin.
Yeah, well, Jack and all reasons. I mean, his big thing, by the way, from his manifesto, you might be interested to go through his promises. Manifesto, and you'll find that not one of them has actually been kept. But his big one, of course, was affordable housing. And he was actually claiming just a couple of weeks ago, in fact, a year ago, just before the last elections, there was a big press release went out saying they've achieved their target on affordable housing, which was 800 a year. In actual fact, it was a projection for the year after. When you actually examined it, it wasn't going to happen anyway. But since then, the actuality's kicked in, and the numbers are actually out. They actually show that in the 4 years that he's actually been in charge, or 5 years now, that the average per year is actually less than half what was achieved in the few years before we had the first mayor. And yet, he was actually claiming in the budget debate how wonderful they'd been in delivering affordable housing. I mean, people are actually being shoved at the moment into substandard housing out in the converted office block up at out on the outskirts of Hengrove, which, you know, really nationally is now actually now being looked at as a bit of a disgrace.
Well, whilst we're talking about housing, I thought it'd be useful to talk about a big eviction that took place this week up the Gloucester Road in Cottam, near just opposite Sainsbury's, and a big old bank that's been empty for 7 years there, which I did a report for Radio Bristol on Wednesday. And I'd just like to, I wonder if we could have a listen now to, because I went up there about lunchtime, and there was a massive crowd. Anyone who was driving up and down Gloucester Road on Wednesday would have seen it, really, any time up until, I suppose, about dusk, around about 6 p.m., around about 100, 120 people on and off gathered around, spectators and supporters of the squatters, who had actually been running what local people described to me as a kind of community centre there. So they'd taken over this large old building, which had been empty for 7 years, to live in, but they'd also kept the ground floor as a community centre for local people, and they were doing things like actually feeding people who were hungry. They had a free shop in there where people could come and pick up clothes and things like that. So it wasn't so surprising to see so many local people turn out to support them during the eviction. So let's go down there now to hear my report on the Gloucester Road eviction on Wednesday this week.
If we carry on supporting each other, we can make this state fall.
That was a Monday.
If they're this scared of this little building, think about what we can do if we run all of Bristol together. Just an idea. Plenty of empty buildings at the moment.
Hello, I'm Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action Movement. This is a resistance to an eviction in Gloucester Road, in the bank, next to the prison. We're here partly because they the squatters involved didn't get a fair trial. They got no trial at all. They were given the wrong time for the Zoom hearing, so they've had no court case. And we're also saying that we're going to start campaigning against the criminalisation of all trespass, which is what the government is now proposing. And we're just saying that people must be allowed to be have a place to live, and they must be allowed to protest and campaign. This is our land, not the government's land, to dole out as they see fit.
You're talking about the criminalising trespass. What's going on with that? Because as far as I know, it's a civil offence, and you know, it's generally quite a light touch, trespassing.
Well, the idea is to criminalise all trespass. This will make any deviation from a public footpath a crime, going onto anyone's land without permission a crime, being in any building a crime, doing any protest a crime, being anywhere that's you're not given permission to a crime. And this just completely stitches up all protest in Britain altogether.
But it's also not necessarily going to be good for travellers, is it?
They'll be completely wiped out. They won't be given any consideration whatsoever, without even being given the chance to have another place that the councils or the government can give them. So it's utterly inhumane.
We live literally right around the corner, and there's a lot of homeless people that are here. For the last month, I'd say these people have been helping more than anything. They've given food and housing to people that have been struggling and just been living on the streets and had to sleep in the cold in like minus degree weather, when the government themselves aren't offering any housing for these people in a pandemic, which is terrifying, because like, if you think about it, the very like health lifestyle that they live, if they got sick, they could die. They are the people that are at risk. And now they're treating these people like criminals, who are the people actually doing the job that they're supposed to be doing as law and order, claiming that they're bringing it. Personally, I think it's just disgraceful that they think they have the right to criminalise these people that are just trying to do good for a community they're claiming to defend.
Why do you think there's so many people here?
Because I think a lot of people agree with me on that point of saying that this is unfair and unlawful in every way. A lot of people support what these people have been doing and have seen the benefits they've given to our community in this area of Bristol. And I think they're angry about it, and I think they should be.
Okay, have you been into there? And have you actually chatted with any of the squatters?
I've chatted with a few of them. There is a homeless man that's normally always outside here, and I used to come and bring him food, and I'd sit down with them, and they'd come and play music with him. They were really, really lovely. They offered me to go in once because they have like a free-to-close thing, but luckily I was quite busy that day. I haven't actually seen inside the building, but having spoken to like four or five of them, they were really, really lovely, kind people. I sat and sang with them, and they were just really, really nice to be around.
It seems like they've got a fair point, because it's a pandemic and they're standing up for people that don't have housing, and it's bullshit having all these empty buildings and they're just sitting there empty when people have nowhere to live, don't have a roof over their heads.
7 years apparently this one's been empty.
Well, there you go.
I think ultimately as well, when there's so many empty buildings that aren't going to be used by social housing and they need that, it's going to be bought by like a big housing company to get it redeveloped that people have to pay loads of money for that no one can afford, but it's just been empty. So either it just stays empty or big companies buy it, like they do it with churches, they do it with empty village halls, everything. And you know, there's so many people that need a home and it's just an empty space.
The problem is that all of these buildings and all of the money in our society stays in the sort of upper class, you know what I mean? It doesn't trickle down. It all stays up there, and as Matty said, it will be bought by someone, a private company, and turned into something that doesn't benefit society when there are people that are homeless. This is commenting on a wider problem in society. Do you know what I mean? I think this is speaking about all of the injustice and the fact that people are suffering.
Especially as there's like a somewhere like Bristol where there's like a huge homeless problem, homeless population, and not enough funding for social care. There is social care available, but there's not enough funding, so people can't access it, people can't kind of make the most of it, really.
Yeah, I guess we want to talk about the no trespassing laws that are coming forwards and how it's about our...
What's happening there? Can you just explain?
So Pigeon Shit Collective have occupied this space. It's a statement about sort of housing and our housing crisis and inaffordability to rent and to buy and things like that. People don't have enough income coming in to support living prices and living costs, and it's about, if we've got abandoned spaces, why can't we occupy them and make them better? You know, why is that illegal? Why are we not allowed to reside in the UK and occupy spaces that are abandoned and being misused? So these trespassing laws and legislations that are being put forward, which are directly incriminating homelessness, wild camping, protest with encampment and occupying buildings that are abandoned. So that's kind of like a really big thing to be criminalising something like that. This building's been empty for 7 years, so I think people are just happy. The What Pigeon Shit Collective have done is just been an open space for community, free shops, workshops. You know, they developed this place a lot more if they were given half the opportunity as a social centre, as a community hub, and the community have felt that. And they just want to say, yeah, great, we love what you're doing, because this building's being left to rot for 7 years. We want to see something happen to it. And what they were doing was obviously something that people support, so that's why they're here. And I did also just want to say, like, the people, you know, we feel passionately about our country and England and the Great Britain and the UK, yet we only have access to less than 10% of that. So, like, you know, we're not even allowed to go anywhere. And I think that's a big issue. Is it our country? Is it our land?
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, my name is Chris Gedge, and I'm here in support for the Pigeon Shark Collective. And basically, like, these people in Occupy movement from London, they've come up here to highlight the fact that our Trespass Act is being, like, revoked from us, potentially. It's gone through, like, a white paper, now it's on the yellow paper. So when that happens, it means that ramblers, people that use bridleways, anyone that trespasses any form of land, i.e. like people who, like, us that live on site, if we're on, like, a land without a building, we don't have any rights anymore. Instantly, and the police can enact it under the CJA amendments that have just been passed through Priti Patel. And so basically they're trying to criminalise, like, about two-thirds of our society in the UK.
So you just explain what's going on. Obviously a lot of people want to know.
Let me tell you, I'm not doing an interview, okay? So I'm in command of an incident which has got about three different problems, some of which are quite risky. Let me go and command that. Our press office are sat in silver with the log. They will know as much as I do, and they'll be able to help you. Okay, you've got the number.
The main question is: this is a lockdown, isn't it? Why are they evicting people in a lockdown?
Sorry, I'm not doing an interview. Press office. Thanks so much, mate. Cheers.
Well, that was the senior officer on the scene, and he didn't give his name. And I at least tried to give him the police an opportunity to explain why they're evicting people during a lockdown. There was an article in the Bristol Post just last week saying another 4 weeks of a stay of evictions, no evictions taking place in the lockdown. We can't really comment, Gary, can we, on the situation with their court appearance on Monday, where the squatters say they had a legal defence. They logged into the Zoom call at the correct time that they were told, it was about half an hour beforehand, only to be told, well, you've got the wrong time, and the court case is all finished with and you've lost. So, you know, they quite understandably, if that's the case, felt rather, you know, cheated of their chance to put in their defence to the court. I guess this is part of the problem. But, I mean, there are big wider questions here, aren't there? Much more really to do with big old buildings standing empty while people are homeless, begging outside Sainsbury's next door.
Well, I think the problem is that we've built so few affordable homes in the city over the last few years that the housing problem is just getting worse and worse. And it's unsurprising that people are very passionate, and I'm afraid that the COVID situation is going to make life even worse. The situation is going to be considerably more difficult. We're going to face more people who are struggling to pay their rent, and although the evictions have been deferred, they haven't gone away, and I think there's going to be an awful lot of particularly younger people in serious difficulties.
Well, you say affordable housing, but of course that housing is not actually affordable for most of the people who are homeless. They don't have anything like the kind of income that is going to get them somewhere to live.
Well, I mean, we started about 12, 15 years ago, we restarted building council houses. And then it sort of stopped again under the previous mayor. They started building a few again now, but the numbers are so pitifully small. But council rents are affordable for people, and they're a fraction of what the private rents are. They might be a little bit closer. We might get more council houses built if the rents were slightly higher, and were still properly affordable. But the cost of housing in this city, one of the reasons it's gone up and up and up is rarity value.
Now, I've jokingly nicknamed our mayor, Marvin Rees Mogg, because of his, it seems, enthusiasm for the Tory policies to do with criminalising travellers. The injunction that he's tried to bring in, and it's obviously that's all gone on hold because there's an election. This is all very embarrassing, potentially, for a Labour mayor candidate to say that he's going to criminalise travellers in Bristol. And he's been playing whack-a-mole for several years with injunctions out of one area where travellers are collecting and another area and another area. There's a problem looming on the Downs. But, Gary, this whole idea of criminalising trespass is a really wide one, which is starting to look a little bit, shall we say, like the far right, you know, having a go at an entire culture who have been around, actually, since time immemorial in Britain.
Well, I'm afraid this is Marvin's style, isn't it? I mean, you know, the dispute he got into with the other council leaders over North Somerset coming into the combined authority. And then he started to try and say it was actually, you know, Bristol was going to be treated unfairly. And then it developed, as the more he carried on, it was very obvious he was developing this us-and-them mentality to try and persuade people in Bristol that he was looking after their interests and the people surrounding the surrounding authorities were trying to grab money that actually belonged to Bristol. It's a divide and rule policy, which is a classic, isn't it, of certain types of regime.
Martin Summers, as a Labour Party, paid-up Labour Party member, are you happy to see a Labour mayor campaigning to criminalise the travellers here in Bristol? The court case, by the way, is coming back. It's already booked in for the autumn, after the elections have all finished, to get these injunctions against travellers in the city, which could mean, well, it would mean basically up to 2 years in prison for any traveller that is once warned and is then found again in the same streets under the injunction area. 2 years in jail just simply for and of course they'll be taking their vehicles. Now, this is actually not a Labour policy, is it? It's just a Conservative policy that is hasn't even been made into law in Westminster yet, but which Rees-Mogg and others are trying to slowly chugging through Westminster in 2021. And it's almost as if the Labour mayor is trying to beat them to it with an even more draconian anti-traveller law.
Well, it's not an anti-traveller law, is it? It's an injunction against specific travellers. Now,
it's injuncting all travellers out of parts of the city.
Yeah, in particular areas, yes. So
well,
it's
where
not
they
a
live,
law,
yeah.
Is it? It's an injunction. That's just a you know, point of order, as it were. I mean, the wider issues are, of course, that the housing policy, central government's housing policy, which has basically hamstrung what councils can do for decades, is responsible for the mess we're in. And, of course, nothing was done about this during the 13 years of Labour government, nor when the Liberal Democrats were in alliance with the Tories in central government. And the real problem was the privatisation of council housing in the 1980s. And nobody can actually say that that was the wrong policy. It was the wrong policy then. It's the wrong policy now. What it did is it bribed former Labour voters in council houses with their own money. They basically made big capital gains out of it. Many of them became, you know, basically property owners on the back of it, hundreds of thousands of pounds. These are the same people, swing voters in marginal constituencies, who switched, you know, the red wall that Keir Starmer is currently wooing. These people basically, when the banking system collapsed, you could turn around to them and say, look, you basically made hundreds of thousands of pounds at the rest of society's expense. Now it's time to pay that back. And of course, nobody wants to say that. So we carry on with an absolutely broken housing system based on the back of the idiotic policy of privatising council housing and not building any more, which is central government policy. And this, of course, means that in actual fact, at local level, there's not much you can do. So all this fantasy about if we change the mayor or change the mayoral system, that this will change the fundamental policy. We need to change the electoral system and change the national government.
Gary, with this, I mean, these poorer people have got a point, haven't they? They need to be able to be somewhere. It looks as if they're going to be stopped from being anywhere. That's the idea of this new law. And let's just take what Martin said to you there. What would your policy be? How would you deal with so many increasing homeless people? I know at the moment there's something like 50 vehicles a night having to park up at the Downs. This is people who've bought vehicles because they can't afford a house.
Well, the first thing is, it's not what we would actually do, it's what we actually did. Because when we were in power, that was in Bristol, that was my responsibility. We actually built two areas that were very popular with travellers, where they could pitch up for building a couple of cases for short periods, and other periods, at times longer periods, they could rent pitches. And the problem actually reduced quite dramatically. It took a little bit of capital, but it worked. In actual fact, we won a national award because of our enlightened policies towards travellers. Because believe it or not, you know, racism isn't trendy and is frowned upon practically everywhere. But some of the people who do that, who quite rightly decry racism, still think it's all right to be anti-gypsy or anti-traveller. We actually did it differently. And what I could say with regard to housing in Bristol, for 50 million quid, you can build an awful lot of council houses. I'm afraid that this mayor has done the wrong things.
Yeah, well, I mean, it does seem they're actually proactively trying to spend quite a lot of money, the same sort of maybe amounts that you're talking about in creating pitches in order to threaten and criminalise travellers at the moment. Anyway, I just find it shocking to see a Labour Party that's basically pursuing an even more far-right anti-traveller policy than Jacob Rees-Mogg. Absolutely shocking. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions this week, where the Bristol South Labour MP, Karen Smith, she was bringing up issues to do with young people and apprenticeships.
Mr. Speaker, this government is failing young people. Before the pandemic, apprenticeship starts were down by 28% for under-19-year-olds, £330 million unspent levy back to the Treasury, falling short by 81% in creating the promised 100,000 new apprenticeships. This month, I will be holding my fifth apprenticeships and jobs fair in Bristol South. Will he join me in urging all young people to support that fair in Bristol South? Or will he apologise to them for failing them so far?
Mr. Speaker, I think jobs fairs are an important thing, and I know that colleagues across the House do them. But I also think that the government can be proud of the record that we've had in getting record numbers of young people into employment. We're now faced with a very severe problem caused by the pandemic, and that's why we're addressing it not just with the lifetime skills guarantee that I mentioned earlier on, but also with the kickstart funds, the restart funds, £2 billion going into kickstart alone to help young people into the jobs that they need.
Martin, there's a serious problem, isn't there, here for youngsters? I mean, we're just hearing about a load of young people there having to live in a squat, basically, so there's nowhere else to go. And now Karen Smith pointing out that the whole system of apprenticeships seems to have fallen apart. It does seem as if young people now today, compared to certainly when we were in our teens or late teens, have got a pretty raw deal when it comes to being able to create an income into the future, some sort of job security, and to start a family.
Yeah, well, there's a great deal of intergenerational injustice going on. And of course, that covers loads of different things. But of course, you know, some elderly people are very poor and some young people are very rich. So it doesn't really, you know, it's really more to do with your economic circumstances. But if you look at latest opinion polls, they show that the under 25s, under 35s overwhelmingly support Labour, the over 65s overwhelmingly support the Conservatives. And of course, the over 65s, the people I was talking about earlier, the people who bought their council houses and made a mint, and those council houses, of course, were there built by the community's resources to be available to the community. If we could, what should be happening after this pandemic, if we had a different kind of government, is there will be a consensus across the parties to do something about social care, to do stuff about council housing. And it's almost as if we can't say the obvious, that we need to put more money into social care, building affordable houses which are really affordable, and not the waiving of stamp duty in order to try and lure young professionals onto the housing ladder and secure their Tory votes under a rigged electoral system which allows a 43% of the vote to get an 80-seat majority for the foreseeable future. Not acceptable in any other country in Europe.
Gary?
Well, basically, the apprenticeship system has broken down. I, through HR committee and council, looking at the system that the city council had tried to operate with the apprenticeship level, and supposedly encouraging apprentices, it's not actually working. It's just full of bureaucracy. And that's not, in this case, that isn't Bristol City Council's fault. That's the national system. The whole problem is short-termism in the way that the economy in this country actually works. So firms are not encouraged to actually invest in training people that they will get a return on. They don't even invest very often in the technology, etc., that they need to. It's getting the quick, short-term profit that the economy's moved towards. And I'm afraid, as we're now moving away from the European model, which is more sensible with Brexit, it's going to get worse. With COVID is a severe threat, more so to younger people, though it's been older people who've had the fatalities, etc. In the short term, in the longer term, younger people are going to suffer more from COVID because of a combination with Brexit, and they're going to be losing jobs.
Okay, so let's go to look at the budget from last week, not this week, last week. And one of the most shocking things in that was this tiny little pay rise for the NHS. I mean, we've had all this trumpeting of how wonderful the NHS is. We've got to save the NHS, save the NHS. And yet the Rishi Sunak from Goldman Sachs, it does seem as if the City of London is really completely colonising central government, as well as the pharmaceutical industry sometimes. And let's have a listen to this exchange, a couple of questions actually, by the Labour leader Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions this week with the Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson over the National Health Service and whether or not the Conservatives are actually telling the truth about saving the NHS.
Mr. Speaker, my mum was a nurse. My sister was a nurse. My wife works in the NHS. I know what it means to work for the NHS. When I clapped for carers, I meant it. He clapped for carers, then he shut the door in their face at the first opportunity. And the more you look at the Prime Minister's decision, the worse it gets. Because it's not just a pay cut, it's a broken promise too. Time and time again, he said that the NHS wouldn't pay the price for this pandemic. Yep. 2 years ago, he made a promise to the NHS, here in black and white, his document, it commits to a minimum pay rise of 2.1%. It's been budgeted for and now it's being taken away. He shakes his head. His MPs voted for it. So why, after everything the NHS has done for us, is he now breaking promise after promise?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, he voted against the document in question, which is to crown the absurdity of his point. This, under this government, we have massively increased funding for our amazing NHS, with the result, as I say, there are 6,500 more doctors this year than there were last year, 18,000 more healthcare workers, and 10,600 more nurses. And we're going to go on, Mr. Speaker, and we are going to deliver our promises. I can tell the Right Honourable Gentleman. We are going to go on, and we're going to build 40 more hospitals, and we're going to recruit 50,000 more nurses, and we're going to get on and deliver on our pledges to the British people. And we're going to do that because of our sound management of the economy and the fastest vaccine rollout programme of any comparable country, which frankly, if we'd followed his precepts and his ideas, we would certainly not have been able to achieve.
He says he voted for it, he did. And now he's ripped it up. 2.1% ripped up. And if the Prime Minister won't listen to me, he should listen to what his own Conservative MPs are saying about this. His own side. This is what they say. Behind you, Prime Minister. It's inept. It's unacceptable. It's pathetic. These are Conservative MPs about the Prime Minister's pay cut for nurses. And that's before his answers today. Another of MPs said this, Mr. Speaker, and this is perhaps the most telling of all the comments. This MP said, sitting behind him, the public just hear 1% and they think how mean we are. Mr. Speaker, even his own MPs know he's got this wrong. Why is he going ahead with it?
Prime Minister. Mr. Speaker, what the public know is that we're increasing pay for starting pay for nurses by 12.8% over the last 3 years. They know that this government in the last year has put another £5,000 bursary into the pockets of nurses because we support them, and as well as the £3,000 extra for training. And of course, it's very, very important that the public sector pay review body should come back with its proposals, and we will, of course, study them. But it, as I say, it is thanks to the investment made by this government that there are 49,000 more people in the NHS this year than last year, 10,600 more nurses helping to relieve the burden on our hard-pressed nurses. That is what this government is investing in.
Well, Martin, the actual figure is something like, at least this is according to the Labour Party, that the nurses during the since the start of the pandemic have, because of this only 1% pay rise, are going to be £841 a year worse off. So it's not, when they say a 1% pay rise, of course, with inflation chugging along as well, that's actually ends up being a pay cut.
Yeah, I mean, what may happen here, as happened over the school meals fiasco last summer, is that Boris will change his mind. I hate calling him Boris. I hate to call him Johnson, shouldn't I? Cut him down to size. They may have to just backtrack on this. Let's hope they do. I mean, that's the purpose of opposition, is to hold their feet to the fire so they do the right thing.
Gary?
Well, I mean, I think this lies down lies and statistics, aren't there? 1% doesn't actually mean 1%. And I'm afraid that the government are going to have to invest more money in the NHS now. It's absolutely inevitable because the NHS coped well. It had to do more work than it should have done because of government incompetence last year and the handling of the pandemic. But they survived. But of course, we have huge backlogs now of heart cancer patients and all sorts of other routine operations. And there's no way that you can actually cut back on the funding of the NHS now, because people will start to realise that, you know, they've been forgiven a lot of things because it was a pandemic and it wasn't the government's fault. But unless the investment is made now, there will be real trouble for the government.
And also, from finally, from Prime Minister's questions, we're going to have a listen to the some. This is from a couple of weeks ago. It's another Bristol MP, and we do occasionally hear from them. I'd like to try and scour Prime Minister's questions every week to see if we do have a Bristol or a local MP saying anything. We haven't heard anything from Kerry McCarthy for quite a while. The Bristol East MP. But anyway, here is Jack Lopresti, that's Filton and Bradley Stoke up in the north of Bristol in Gloucestershire, talking here a couple of weeks ago at Prime Minister's Question about something called the Great Western Freeport. Now, before he does, Gary, can you just tell us what's going on here? Because I understand that, you know, we've got the old Avonmouth docks, we've got Portbury docks, which is a much bigger dock for deeper, you know, draft ships. they're now talking about building out into the Severn Estuary a much deeper port to take even bigger ships. So what's this Great Western Freeport? What's the big idea?
Well, the Freeport is a tax scam, basically. What it does do, if you give a certain area tax-free status, you will get extra jobs in there, but some of those jobs will have come elsewhere, and of course the revenue is not coming into the government. So this was boosted up by the present Metro Mayor saying it was going to be a wonderful scheme that was going to make everybody in the area rich and give 50,000 extra jobs. And then the government refused to back it and didn't declare the Freeport. I find it hysterically funny that it's actually in Conservative leaflets that are actually being distributed at the moment. What a wonderful boon the Bristol Freeport is going to be, and it's not happening.
Well, say it's not happening. But anyway, Jack Lopresti, I think, would beg to differ. Let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions from a couple of weeks ago about the Great Western Freeport, then.
Said to the Southwest with Jack Lopresti. Jack.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My right honourable friend will recall from his visit in 2019 that the Port of Bristol will make an excellent location for a Great Western Freeport. And the West of England Mayor Tim Bowles has submitted a bid which could create 50,000 jobs in the region. Will the Prime Minister back our bid and also agree with me that with house prices in the west of England sitting at 9 times average earnings, we need a home building revolution to provide much more affordable housing for our young people as we build back better?
Prime Minister.
My honourable friend is absolutely right in what he says about home building and about the need for housing across the country, because you sometimes hear that, oh, this is a problem just mainly in London and the South. It's not at all. It's everywhere in the country, as he rightly says. And I want to thank, by the way, Tim Bowles for what he's done, the mayor for the West of England, or everything that he has done now as he stands down. And we intend to help build on his legacy with a massive home building programme and home ownership programme. Home ownership programme, Mr. Speaker, across the country.
Well, actually, of course, Boris didn't mention the Great Western Freeport at all. I think you could be right, Gary. They want nothing to do with it.
Well, no, there was five of them announced in the budget. I think it was five. Bristol wasn't one of them. There was Teesside and two or three other places, but not Bristol. And I'm amazed as to how incompetent the choreography's been, with MPs asking questions, they're going in all their leaflets, this is going to be happening. And all of a sudden, the Chancellor said no. Amazing.
Okay. Well, it's not okay. So we've got the Metro Mayor elections also taking place in May. Can you just give us an idea of, you standing a candidate for the Lib Dems and what is the area and what's the main, what's the responsibility, the difference between the Mayor and the Metro Mayor? I think this was always going to be a bit complicated, wasn't it?
Well, the Metro Mayor is effectively a convener and a figurehead for the West of England. Unfortunately, it's only three authorities now because Marvin managed to block the re-entry of North Somerset, which was very, very bad for the economics of the area. And basically, the Metro Mayor has actually had power devolved down to there, and power shifted from authorities like Bristol up to there. So there's an awful lot of political power with the West of England mayor position. It's going to be a straight contest between the Tories and our candidate, Stephen Williams.
No, why not Labour? They did quite well last time, didn't they?
They did, but their popularity has gone down since. We, in the meantime, have actually had swept the board in Bath and North East Somerset. There are now more Liberal Democrat councillors in the West of England than any other party, including the Tories. And the Labour Party is sort of third on the list. And, there's a tiny number of green councillors across the area. So it's likely to be a two-way contest. And Labour, of course, have picked Dan Norris, who was never a very popular figure in the first place. And they did have a female cabinet member from Bristol who was lying against it, but the party machine didn't want that.
Well, yeah, the party machine seems to be all-powerful, you know, even intervening in local parties, as we heard last week in Bristol West Labour Party being basically hijacked by the Central Labour Party mechanisms. Martin, this Metro Mayor business, though, it's a very bizarre situation to have somebody who is not actually running a city, but he's running a kind of, if you draw a line about 40, 30 miles out of the city and round, in order to make sure that a Labour majority, a working class majority in the city, doesn't affect the mayor position, and that they make sure that they've got plenty of rural Tory voting homeowners picking the Metro Mayor.
Well, I mean, the system by which we elect local authorities is basically a dog's breakfast now. It's a complete mess with lots of, you know, competing jurisdictions and all the rest of it. I mean, the creation of the Avon County Council back in the 1970s, that does, you know, there is actually an argument in having, you know, regional decision making, because things like transport, for example, can't be done within a city boundary. So it shouldn't necessarily be seen as a way of gerrymandering. But of course, in a sense, it is. I mean, Kingswood, traditionally working class area of Bristol, is not part of Bristol City Council. And that, of course, is just basically gerrymandering. And we're going to see more of this going forward, because the Tories intend to redraw the constituency boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral registers, which are themselves extremely incomplete. And also very worrying is they're talking about you're going to have a photo ID in order to vote, even though large numbers of people do not have driving licenses and do not have passports. This is imported from the United States, this whole idea of gerrymandering once you've got in a position to gerrymander. And, of course, it's all based on first past the post. Obviously, the mayor, the Metro Mayor, I believe there's one transfer vote in it, so it makes it more proportional than it otherwise might be. I mean, you can see the mayoral system has had to be based on some kind of proportion, because otherwise you're going to end up with somebody with 20% of the vote and 100% of the power. And that's why they had to bring it in. And of course, we're going to have the elections to the Welsh Assembly and to the Scottish Parliament in May, which will be under a form of proportional representation. Now, if we had proportional representation, which Gary and I agree about, I'm sure, we would have a completely different political system with a completely different way of doing politics. Because in order to win, you would have to reach out beyond your tribal allegiances in order to achieve coalitions. This is normal stuff in Ireland, normal stuff in Denmark, normal stuff in Norway. Even in France, they have a two-round system to make sure that you don't end up with somebody in power who hasn't got a mandate. And this is a lot of the roots of the problems of the way this country has been run in my lifetime, from the 1970s onwards, is that the political system is for the knacker's yard, and it's led to all sorts of disasters, including the effectively no-deal Brexit, which we're now facing up to, because the European Parliament are not going to ratify the agreement that Boris Johnson signed with them unless he accepts the Northern Ireland Protocol.
Gary, what do you reckon to the system? Because I mean, it sounds to me like you think you may be in with a chance of winning the Metro Mayor under the present system.
Well, we might be, and actually the boundary for the Metro Mayor is absolutely right, as Martin said. We actually, it's a very efficient economic unit, the west of England, with most of it being self-contained. You can't deal with the transport system at a Bristol level. It has to be done at a Wecker level. And that's why Marvin's whistling in the dark is so ludicrous. If you're going to have people who live outside the city, travel in, etc., you can't then start fighting with the neighbours, as Marvin's trying to do. And the system that's actually there is one where if we actually get into second place on first preferences, we're likely to win. Because we will get a lot of second preference votes, whereas the Tory will not. So, you know, we have a
Okay, we'll wind up in a minute, but before you go, Gary, I think we'll be talking about this a little bit more, but the big story of the week, like it or not, I'm afraid, is the Meghan Markle's interview with Oprah Winfrey. But before we do that, I thought it'd be useful to also have a look at the this rather horrific story we've had this week, which is to do with the murder of a woman as she's walking home in London. Now, I'm quite, you know, her name's Sarah Everard. It looks as if, anyway, her body has been found now and identified. The suspect arrested is a guy called Wayne Cousins. But we are seeing a lot of news coverage this week from the London media, all about, I mean, even with one of the Green Party, Jenny Jones, former Green Party leader, suggesting that we should have 6 p.m. curfews for all men to stop them being out in the streets on fear of arrest and criminalisation, hopefully not being shot. Anyway, in order to prevent things like this. But this is what I would suggest is a kind of proper agenda going on here. Martin, you know, we use this term quite a lot, where they try and steer the question away from the real issue. And for me, the real issue is that it looks as if, and we don't know for sure anyway, that this murder was carried out by a serving police officer, and not just any old serving police officer, but somebody who was part of the anti-terrorism command. Martin, maybe you could start by saying, well, you know, this is pretty shocking, isn't it? And although we don't know that this guy is responsible, that he's now been arrested as a suspect in this case. Not only that, a decent exposure 3 days before the disappearance of Sarah Everard. It does look as if we've also covered many times on this program the apparent total lack of accountability of police. Things like the many deaths in custody without one single police officer being convicted of those for those deaths, manslaughter or anything else. And also, of course, the police actually shooting and killing people in the streets and not being tried for that either. So that surely is the big question here. A police officer involved, we need to have a very close look at the police. But no, we're being told by the mass media it's all men who are responsible for this crime.
Well, it's difficult to comment on an individual case because, as we know, it's an individual case. It's not that surprising at the end of the day that some criminals are police officers. In fact, you know, if you talk to police officers, they'll be absolutely clear with you that they know that that's the case. And it would be surprising if it were not so. I mean, they're in a position of authority and power. And one of the things I heard suggested, although we obviously haven't come to court yet, is that he was able to get this young woman into his confidence by showing her his warrant card. You know, that's an abuse of power by any definition. The wider questions of the accountability of the police force, the security services, the military. We've just seen, you know, Keir Starmer whipping the Labour Party to vote against these illiberal bills to give these state institutions a get out of jail free card. I'm glad to say that the other opposition parties did not see fit to give the government a blank check on that.
I wonder if you'd agree with me, Gary, though, that there's been a sort of steering of the news agenda here, looking at all men as potential rapists rather than questioning whether a police officer, you know, it should have been better vetted or whatever to take on that role.
Well, there are two issues which are colliding in this particular case. Incidentally, we don't know the full details of it yet. I think there's a fair amount of confidence this bloke's responsible, but whether it was a random act or whether he'd been harassing this woman and stalking her beforehand, we don't know. But it is certainly true, and I can tell you from my experience of being in charge of community safety for Bristol for a number of years, that it's very difficult for a lot of men to actually accept that their behaviour, how threatening it actually is. And it does need to be looked at and checked. Now saying that men aren't allowed out at night, I think that's a little extreme. But we do need to look at people feeling safe, men and women being able to feel safe and being able to walk the streets. Now, safety in this country is better than a number of other places, but we do need to make certain that people do vote.
That's right. I totally agree with you. But then there's also the issue, isn't there, Martin, that we've had over the last 20, 30 years a slow ramping back of basic social security. So there are more and more desperados out there who it may be that they've just either fallen on bad times or whatever, and they have some sort of resentment. But just a society that's almost not at ease with itself anymore.
If it ever was, Tony. I think, you know, this comes back to very basic stuff, like, are there streetlights? Are we paying for streetlights? Things like that. I mean, community safety is actually, you know, you've got to build it into what you're doing. Have you got, proper control of entry and exit into public property and so forth? I mean, we've had all this austerity, which was proven to be wrong now. I think perhaps the only thing that we might get out of this COVID crisis is the understanding for ordinary people that the national budget is not like a household, and that the coalition between the Liberals and the Conservatives as we all know when it was, the whole idea of trying to cut back public expenditure in the middle of a deflationary recession, which is what's going to happen next, is just wrong. And in actual fact, if you try and do it, what happens is the economy goes down faster and the budget deficit goes bigger.
Well, we've also had a massive cut, haven't we, back in actual police employed.
That's right. So the government boasts about how they're going to recruit 22,000 new police officers. Well, that's because they've retired 22,000 police officers that should never have needed to be retired. And, of course, all the training and experience of those people goes out the window while you do it. At the same time, we close things like public lavatories. And we can afford, incidentally, on Brexit, it looks like our exports to the European Union fell by 40% in January, even though our exports to the rest of the world were untouched. So I think we're looking for a baseball bat in the face there.
Well, maybe, Martin, or maybe it's just that it's all the paperwork that people have been getting used to, and we'll see what the February figures are. But anyway, we have a look at Meghan Markle now. So before you go, Gary, I'd just like you to have a listen to a little clip here. This is with Piers Morgan and Alex Beresford clashing on his Good Morning Britain programme. I wonder, just before we hear, though, what are your thoughts about the sacking of Piers Morgan?
Do you think it's racist? It's a legitimate question many people have asked. Is it racist, do you think, if for argument's sake it was William? Or Charles. Let's not put a name to this person. We don't know. And part of the problem, and I know you agree with me about this, it'd be easier if they just said who it was.
Right.
Right? I'll come to that. But is there a difference? If it was said, perhaps in all innocence, right, and they just said, oh, what colour baby might you have, without any suggestion of it being a concern or a worry if it had darker skin, would that in itself, would just the question be racist?
That in itself is fine, but you have to think about how it feels on the receiving end, because what we're speculating is as to how that message...
Yeah, I don't know how it was communicated. Right, but what I would say to you is, if it was done as a worry or concern...
We also have to take into consideration how it felt. The other thing that we also have to think about, and I've publicly said this on Twitter, Piers, I agree with you now that I feel that they should have named the person, because all it's led to is all of us asking loads of questions, and I personally am looking at the royal family as to... Which one could
Who's
it be?
Who's the racist, yeah.
Who's the racist? But again, we have to also just take a step back. Do you know how much courage it takes to actually speak about racism, to actually call it out? Because I've been in situations where I haven't called out every single bit of racism that's happened to me based on how I've been treated or how it was handled in the past.
Because you're worried about a backlash.
And you're also worried about a backlash. And there will be people that would treat Harry and Meghan differently because they've spoken out.
Okay.
But this is the whole thing. We've got to get comfortable talking about the uncomfortable. And that's why it's important for me and you to have this conversation.
Right, but let's just not make it personal. That's fine.
He basically said, I don't believe Meghan Markle, and was sacked as a result, wasn't he?
I think there's been an awful lot of people yelling off opinions about things that they know very little about. We do not know what has happened within the royal family. We do not know the detail of the relationships. And quite frankly, we've had all sorts of people generalising about things when they know very little. That is what do
Okay, so let's have a listen now to Piers Morgan and Alex Beresford clashing over the Prince Harry and the Meghan Markle interview.
Here's a clip of Meghan talking about her dad with Oprah during that interview and that situation right before her wedding when they found out that Thomas was working with the tabloids.
We called my dad and I asked him, and he said, no, absolutely not. Mm. And I said, you know, the institution has never intervened for anything for us, but they can try to go in and kill this story. But if they do this once, we're not going to be able to use that same leverage to protect our own kids one day.
He said, no, absolutely not. He hadn't been talking to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he basically lied to you.
Well, and so when I said we won't be able to protect our own kids one day,
uh-huh.
And I said, so I just need you to tell me. And if you tell me the truth, we can help. And he wasn't able to do that. Uh-huh. And that for me has really resonated, especially now as a mother.
Uh-huh.
You know,
not being willing to protect you.
And also me saying just full stop, if we use this to protect you, we won't be able to protect our own children one day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm talking about your grandchildren.
Their relationship fell apart after Thomas decided to work with the tabloids leading up to their royal wedding.
There's a lot that's been lost already.
Mm.
And I grieve a lot. I mean, I've lost my father. I lost a baby. I nearly lost my name. I mean, there's the loss of identity, but I'm still standing.
She didn't lose me. I would have always been there for her. I'm there for her now if she wants me.
In a bonus clip from Sunday's interview, which aired on CBS This Morning Monday, Meghan opened up about the moment she confronted her father and asked if he was working with the tabloids.
We called my dad and I asked him, and he said, no, absolutely not.
Mm.
And I said, you know, the institution has never intervened for anything for us, but they can try to go in and kill this story. But if they do this once, we're not going to be able to use that same leverage to protect our own kids one day. And if you tell me the truth, we can help. And he wasn't able to do that.
In addition to the privacy and copyright infringements that Meghan is suing the Mail on Sunday for, she also filed subsequent claims against the Mail on Sunday that they had actively contributed to the breakdown of the relationship with her father.
Thomas ultimately missed his daughter's wedding after suffering a heart attack. And on Tuesday, he recalled the phone conversation he had with his then soon-to-be son-in-law.
Harry had said to me at that point, if you had listened to me, this wouldn't have happened to you. And me laying in a hospital bed after I've had a procedure and getting a stent put here and a stent put here, felt that that was kind of snotty, so I hung up on him.
That was the last time Thomas says he spoke to his daughter.
That was to do with the breakdown of the relationship, really, between Meghan Markle and her father. Now, it just seems to be becoming a bit of a habit because she's broken down the relationship with her husband. She's relationship with her half brother and her half sister is also broken down. Her half brother wrote to Prince Harry just before the wedding and said that, you know, don't do this. It's going to be a complete disaster for the royal family if you do. And now she's done the same with the royal family too, Gary. The question is really, though, whether or not we can believe what Meghan Markle says and, you know, whether there is real racism within the royal family, because the main point she was making was that someone was asking in the royal family about the colour of her child's skin and whether that was going to allow them to become a prince or not. But certainly, I mean, I looked into that afterwards, as many other journalists did. And, you know, for example, Prince Andrew's grandchildren aren't princes and won't be princes, or they may be at some point in the future. But she seems to think that because it's her daughter and Harry's daughter, it should be made a prince. That's not correct under royal protocol. You've got to be the granddaughter or grandson of a reigning monarch. And Archie wasn't. So she was kind of expecting him to be a prince and was disappointed for fake reasons, it seems. But anyway, what do you make of this, and what does it say about the royal family and about the media?
Well, I think it says media ought to have better things to spend his time on, rather than lots of the infighting of a family. Secondly, that I personally don't pay any attention to what goes on within the royal family, because I've got things that I can affect in Bristol, and the way that things are done here can affect them to some extent. I can't affect what goes on within the royal family. And quite frankly, I think it's a pity that with all the important things that's going on in the world, one of the biggest stories has been he said, she said, within our family.
What about the sacking of Piers Morgan, though? I mean, it does look... I was thinking immediately, oh, well, he's just going to take a break and then he's coming back with Rupert Murdoch or... what's his name? Andrew Neil's brand new channels that are going to be launching very soon. So he's having a bit of a holiday for broadcasting, really, and he will be popping up on one of those.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. As I said, this story is not something I can affect. And really, I make comments on things that I know stuff about.
I mean, are you a royalist yourself?
Not particularly, but I'm not anti-royalist either. They're actually the royal family. It's an anachronism, but they're actually quite good for the British economy, aren't they? With some money that's actually brought in with tourists and whatever. So basically, no, I'm not pro or anti-royalist. It's just not a subject that actually interests me.
Okay, Gary, thanks. Martin?
Well, I can see why you'd rather talk about this than Brexit.
And is the royal family racist? Doesn't that matter?
To some extent, yes, but Brexit matters more.
Martin, I must ask you to just, if you don't want to say anything at all about the Meghan Markle interview, whether it's to do with racism in the royal family, whether it's to do with, the constitution of the country, or whether it's to do with, whether there's someone as a head of state or not, and what the ramifications might be, that's fine. But just say, I don't want to say anything.
Well, I'm just... you yourself were talking about how the media frames what we talk about, and that is propaganda. Now, something like the royal family and even the rows are going on in the royal family mean that people's bandwidth is taken up with that rather than things that they might need to think about.
Well, you think that people shouldn't be thinking about this? I think that's absolutely fine to think about this, because this is the royal family. They're the head of state. They're quite an important group. And I think it would be remiss to just ignore the big story of the week.
I think you're right in a sense, but you're following the tabloids. Whereas we're not actually talking about what you might call serious politics. And of course, that's what's happened to serious politics. It becomes take your position on Meghan Markle rather than what's going to happen with the economy as we move forward, which is actually quite drastically bad in all sorts of respects.
Yeah, you can talk about both, can't you? Anyway, Meghan's royal protection accusations, some of these are basically lies, because she's saying that we were being singled out when they weren't. All of the royals are treated in the same way like that. I just think it's fascinating to see that Thomas Markle, her father, who she's totally offed, wasn't interviewed anywhere on most of the media apart from on Piers Morgan's programme. And I imagine that some of the presenters will say, well, he's elderly, he's a bit incoherent. I mean, he doesn't come across all that well because he's 75 and he's actually just had a couple of years ago, had a heart operation. But what he's saying basically is that Meghan has been lying. She's been not telling the truth about her relationship with him, that he's desperate to hear from her and he would very much like to speak to her again before he dies, but she won't speak to him. Anyway, I think these things are actually quite interesting in that it gives you some insight into the rights and wrongs of the various characters. I mean, particularly, we're going to be talking in the next hour, Martin, about Edward and Mrs. Simpson and how that affected the royals back in the 1930s. But before that, let's have a little bit of music. We've got a little break now. Thank you very much to our guest, Gary Hopkins, who is the leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council here and the Lib Dem councillor for Knoll.
And we're going to have some music from The Flashing Blade from 1967.
You want for all that you believe. It's right to fight for what we want, to live the way we please. As long as we have done our best, then no one can do more. And life and love and happiness are well worth fighting for. That will fall. It's better to have fought and lost than not have fought at all. Let's always take whatever comes and never try to hide. Face everything and anyone together, side by side. Fight for what you want, for all that you believe. It's right to fight for what we want, to live the way we please. As long as we have done our best, then no one can do more. And life and love and happiness are well worth fighting for. They're well worth fighting for.
Oh,
Oh, well, that's from 1967, Fight the Flashing Blade, followed by Open Up with left field Johnny Rotten, Johnny Lydon from 1989 from the Sex Pistols. Left field and the Sex Pistols, what a wonderful combination. Anyway, the thanks very much to Gary Hopkins for that first hour. We're into hour two now with just Martin Summers and I. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is still with us. We'll be talking tonight about a sort of spin-off from the Meghan Markle story, which is she a victim of royal racism or of a Hollywood psyop? Echoes, perhaps, of the pre-war scandal with Edward and Mrs. Simpson abdicating from the firm back in 1936. Looking at the traitor king tonight, Edward Windsor, and his timeline of treachery with Karina Urbach, who wrote a book called Go-Betweens for Hitler, which uncovered some incredible stuff about just what a Nazi Edward VIII was back in the 1930s and even through the war, to such an extent that he had to be taken over to the Bahamas. So the royal family and relationships within it actually do matter. The e-books that I've written, that's three of those, published in the Halloween lockdown, The Traitors of Arnhem, which is about Martin Bormann and the foundation of the Bilderberg conferences back in the end of the Second World War and in the 1950s. Then there's also The Siege of Heaven and The Siege of Heaven Reader, one of which is the collection of my articles and the other one which is a collection of interesting extracts since the sort of end of the medieval period around secret societies and secret control of politics and government and religion. So you can get free watermark versions of those, which I've been sending out with some of my weekly emails. If you'd like to get on my weekly email list, by the way, and thank you for those of you who have emailed me over the last week, wanting to join, just email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. That's cultureshop, S-H-O-P, .org.uk, and I'll add you onto the list. I'm trying at the moment to try and find a decent free list that I can put you on, but they've mostly been shut down. There's something called MailChimp, which is just a complete and utter nightmare. I would advise nobody to ever use it. And it keeps coming out with errors all over the place. But anyway, Martin, on the big issues of the week, I think we'll probably start just with Hong Kong, because we've seen another big change this week where the Chinese Beijing government are going to be vetting all the candidates that are allowed to stand in Hong Kong from now on. And we're going to be hearing from Peter Ford with his views on it in a minute. But the people of Hong Kong seem to have been kind of sold down the river, really, by Chris Patton back in 1987, although I suppose we didn't have much of a choice, really.
Well, the Chinese government's position, as you know, is that, you know, there never was a democratic structure inside Hong Kong. And they took it over as what they perceived to be a going concern oligarchy. And they, you know, that's their attitude, rightly or wrongly. And the balance of forces, as you rightly point out, is such that it's virtually impossible for anybody to change their minds if they don't want to change it. Of course, the real political significance for Britain is that up to 3 million Hong Kong Chinese could become citizens of this country, which will be very interesting if we're in the middle of a major recession with mass unemployment.
Okay, so anyway, let's have a listen to the former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, who I spoke to yesterday. He had quite a lot to say about what's going on over in China. I'm just having a look to see if I can find out whereabouts that is, because his attitude, anyway, maybe it's not one of the clips that I've got ready, but I think his attitude, Martin, is basically, well, it's there's nothing really we can do. And the other thing is, he's saying that we have made things worse by encouraging these demonstrations that were taking place with millions of Hong Kongers coming out onto the streets.
Well, I mean, as a former ambassador, he's basically telling people the inside gen about this. Western intelligence services have worked very hard to stir up people in Hong Kong. And, you know, they're basically prepared to fight to the last Hong Konger. Their goal is to cause embarrassment and difficulty for the Chinese regime. And in that, they have succeeded. But whether that was in the best interest of Hong Kong is another question. I would argue it was in the best interest of Hong Kong to push for the maximum autonomy possible within the structure of power that the Chinese regime represents. That would have been, you know, basically in their interest. But pushing for things like total independence was obviously going to be a red rag to a bull to the Chinese regime. And, of course, what happens is, ultimately, they've put their foot down and said, well, you're not having that. So, and of course, in the past, they were willing to kind of negotiate and hum and haw about things. And now they said, well, any concessions we make, you just demand more. And we're just going to put our foot down and you're not going to have anything.
Yeah, well, I know you're quite a supporter of the Chinese way of doing things.
No, I'm not, Tony. I'm just telling you that Peter Ford is a former British diplomat, and he's telling you how it actually works. It's all very well saying I'm a supporter of the regime. I'm not. I'm just telling you, we're not going to war with China over Hong Kong.
We're just not going to do it. I would say you're probably right. But anyway, the actual way that people are being treated in China is pretty appalling in terms of the surveillance. Although, of course, that surveillance does go on here, as we pointed out last week, you know, with the whole blacklisting of usually union activists, but also environmental activists, anybody that's basically an activist. You know, it seems like we're dealing with a complete and utter control freakery, both in the West and over there. It's just a little bit more subtle over here, a bit more, you know, in a way, the West is more like Brave New World and China is like 1984, Martin. Is that a reasonable comparison?
No, I think it's actually both the West and China are far more complicated than using simple analogies suggest. You know, China today, for example, is very different from the China of 20 years ago, and in many respects a more open society than it was then.
Well, it isn't for the Uyghurs, is it, obviously?
Well, all right, but I mean, but compared to the Cultural Revolution, you had a Uyghur representative on last week, and they were saying, well, during the Cultural Revolution, we really were under the cosh, and then things eased up a bit. And, of course, after Tiananmen Square, they went back down again. And now, of course, with an ongoing confrontation between the West and China, the Chinese hardliners are in the ascendant for sure, because that's because we've got people in the White House and in Dominic Raab basically saying we want to overthrow the regime in China.
So you're
the Chinese just say, well, no, you're not going to do
the
that
West for the authoritarianism of the Chinese government.
I didn't quite catch that, Tony. Sorry.
Are you blaming the West for the reason that China is so authoritarian?
The relationship between China and the West was gradually improving, but once 9/11 happened and all the rest of it, we've got basically an illegitimate criminal regime in the West based around 9/11, and they basically want to take out the opposition all around the world, the Russians and the Chinese. The Russians have got a democratic system, more democratic than the United States of America, if I may say. And, of course, in Syria, they had an election in 2014, which we've completely ignored. And Peter Ford, of course, who we hope we're going to hear from, he was the British ambassador in Syria before that. The real world isn't just about goodies and baddies, right and wrong, authoritarian regime. There's an authoritarian regime in Saudi Arabia, which is carrying out the most biggest genocide on the planet as we speak, fully supported by RAF personnel. The Chinese just shrug their shoulders and say, you don't know what you're talking about. Why pick on us? What about what you're doing?
Well, I suppose the reason they're picking on them is because of Hong Kong, and also because they're a far, far more populous, greater power. But anyway, let's have a listen to Peter Ford now. And it is this week 10 years since the beginning of the Syrian civil war. So I asked him about that and, you know, really, I suppose, about the war itself.
It was planned beforehand by an unholy alliance that the Western powers that had been preparing from Jordan south to the south, preparing jihadi forces, and on the other side you had the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been active in Syria for many years and which was just waiting for an opportune moment, which came along with the Arab Spring, and they saw how the Western powers had overcome Gaddafi, and so the people, the jihadi people in Syria, thought it was an opportune time. They got some civilians to start a demonstration. The Syrian security forces overreacted a bit, and that was then lighting the blue touch paper. Then you got the agent provocateur, the snipers firing into a crowd, and the whole thing just took off like gunpowder.
Okay. So, what about today? Where are we now?
The situation's stagnant. There's a military standoff. Assad controls 70% of the country. There are only two big pockets in the north and northeast that are not under Assad's control. One is under the control of Al Qaeda, effectively Idlib. Supported by the West, and the other is actually occupied by American forces acting in cahoots with some Kurdish militia forces. And unfortunately, that area happens to be where Syria's oil is and where most of its grain is. So they're depriving the rest of Syria very important resources, and along with sanctions, that is causing very, very severe hardship in Syria. It's very hard to see how this logjam can be broken. There's a military stalemate, I would predict that it's going to look much, much the same in a year's time.
So this is it's not the first time this sort of thing has happened in the Middle East. We seem to be seeing a kind of balkanization going on. In fact, this has been happening over many, many, probably at least a century or more, that these borders are being redrawn. So do you think these new borders are stalemate? Will eventually form borders of new nations of some sort?
Well, there's a very definite risk of that. I'm reminded of Cyprus, where the Turks have been in effective control of northern Cyprus since about 1975. And that's supposed to be temporary. But the Turks, the same Turks, are in control of Idlib and a sliver of territory along that northern border of Syria. And putting down roots, introducing Turkish currency, post offices, schools. We're seeing the de facto partitioning of Syria, and with the Americans controlling the northeast, it's not a good prospect.
Well, look. I'm sure the Turks would say it is a good prospect. They look back to over 100 years ago when this region was part of the Ottoman Empire, controlled from Istanbul.
That's right. In fact, all the countries in the present-day Middle East are artificial, the result of a carve-up when the Ottoman Empire collapsed in 1918. And we and the French, and then later on the Americans, came along to carve out respective spheres of influence. And we created the country of Syria and the country of Lebanon, the country of Iraq, the territory of Palestine. Most of it was what they called Bilad al-Sham, the country of Syria. It was all greater Syria, but over 100 years we've been seeing a dismemberment of greater Syria, and what's happening today is the next and possibly final step towards the dismemberment of Syria at the hands of the great powers.
Well, this obviously benefits Turkey. Are there any other powers in the Middle East that this benefits?
Well, Iran stands in the way of this dismemberment, and this is where there's some cause for hope. Iran has done a great job fighting ISIS and helping Assad to resist regime change at the hands of the West. And Iran should not be underestimated.
Okay, so that's the former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, there speaking to me yesterday. Martin, he's really there saying that the chunks of Syria that are still left, the Turks and the Americans, it's quite amazing, isn't it, that we've got the Americans supporting al-Qaeda and Iran fighting ISIS. One wonders which side we're really on.
Well, I don't think there's much doubt which side we're really on. We're on the side of al-Qaeda, as we were in the 1980s in Afghanistan. Incidentally, something that has happened this week, which is worthy of note, is that has been a massive attack, missile attack, on the oil production facilities, which are controlled by the Kurdish faction in alliance with the United States in northern Syria. They've been basically stealing the oil. As Trump said, we're going to stay to keep the oil. And they've been taking oil out of there and selling it on the black market and using it to finance their attempts to keep the, you know, to keep control of it and so on. But the Russians, it seems, without making much of a song and dance about it, have basically blown up all the facilities in which this oil is being kept in order to be sold onto the black market. And basically, you know, they're basically saying, if we can't have this oil, we're not going to let you have it. And the other thing that may happen soon is that the Syrian army will close in on the Idlib pocket and drive everybody in. You know, they'll leave the border to Turkey open so that they can flee over the border. And of course, lots of Uyghurs are inside the Idlib pocket. They've been trained and armed now by the Turks. And of course, what the Chinese are worried about is they're going to end up back in Xinjiang province killing Chinese soldiers, because that's the long-term plan that Erdogan has.
The British jihadis that MI5 have let back here, but they won't let Shamima Begum back.
Well, that's right. I mean, we covered that last week. I mean, Peter Ford, I have to say, has been an exemplary in his analysis of all of this. He was the former British ambassador to Syria. He knows what he's talking about, and he knows that we have been supporting jihadi terrorism in Syria.
Well, one of the other things he said, and Martin, there's a longer interview here, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I'll put the complete interview with Peter up on there tonight, and you can download that and have a listen. But one of the things he says is he was actually saying how sad it is that Trump is no longer around, because one of the things he was doing in Syria was doing everything he could to pull the US troops out of Syria. And yet he was then finding that he'd issued twice different orders to pull the troops out, only to be undermined and countermanded by the Pentagon.
Well, that's right. And if Biden isn't going to do that, but even if he wanted to, he wouldn't be allowed to. And of course, what Trump famously said is, well, we'll stay and keep the oil. But what the Russians have done, with presumably in consultation with the Syrians, is, you know, we're not going to let you have that oil. Basically, they've wiped out the possibility of using that oil to finance further insurgency. And ultimately, of course, when they've captured the Idlib pocket, they're going to drive everybody. They're going to take control of every inch of the country. And of course, Assad has also said we're then going to go and take the Golan Heights.
Isn't this what the Western intelligence forces do, though? They seem to go and grab the resources, whether they be oil, grain, cocaine, and then use them to fund black projects.
Yes, I mean, that's their modus operandi. The other thing, of course, is the other week Biden attacked the border post between Iraq and Syria. It was actually on the Iraqi side of the border that he attacked, and he killed Iraqi militia forces, quite a lot of them, who were actually part of the Iraqi armed forces. Now, what we could easily happen here, and I think other things I've been reading this week are very worrying about developments in the Ukraine, is that we're going to have all of these wars well, now, you know, now Biden is in control. Trump basically wasn't a team player as far as the deep state were concerned. I mean, you know, but he was a reckless person in any case. I mean, he was the one who ordered Soleimani assassinated, no doubt, on the orders of the people giving him orders. And of course, the Israelis, who've probably got an election coming up soon, are very, very keen to have an all out war on Iran. And of course, that is the sort of thing that Dominic Raab and Boris Johnson are going to have to think about, and Keir Starmer too.
So the Pope has been visiting Iraqi Christians this week, victims, according to antiwar.com, of US foreign policy. The Iraqi Christians, the victims of US foreign policy.
Well, very much so, because in the Saddam regime, you know, repressive and horrible as it was, he was an equal opportunity repressor. And basically, the more extreme elements in each of these communities there were very much held in check by the Ba'athist setup. And the Christians, who are a very significant minority in Iraq and have been for many years, they have been driven out or killed by the non-Christian factions. But I think it is significant that Sistani, who is the lead, you know, the in many ways the religious leader of Shia in Iraq, met with the Pope, and there must have been all sorts of negotiations about that. And Sistani is, in fact, you know, a voice of reason in Iraq in many respects. When the Paul Bremer and the occupation authority said, well, we don't need to have any elections around here, we'll just run it, Sistani said, no, you're not doing that. We're going to have an election here. And, of course, there has been a vote in the Iraqi Houses of Parliament that all foreign forces should leave forthwith. That is to say, US forces. But they haven't gone. And that means, of course, war. Of course it does. What else can it be?
Okay, well, actually, they are saying, that, also on antiwar.com, that if the US forces leave, that they won't be attacked. They're promising them, if you leave your bases, we will let you leave without attacking you, which I suppose is the least that the Americans can expect, having brought such misery with the British and Tony Blair to that whole region. But anyway, Martin, a little bit of good news, I suppose. We've got countries now pushing back against US sanctions at the United Nations. The Trump administration left many countries under crippling sanctions that are still in place. China, Russia, North Korea, Iran and other countries, 16 altogether. I'll run through a list of the rest, which is Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, Algeria, Angola, Belarus, Bolivia, Eritrea, Laos, Nicaragua, Cambodia, St. Vincent, and the Grenadines. All of these places are under US sanctions. And they're saying, well, look, to the UN, we've had enough of this.
Yeah, I mean, all of these sanctions have no basis in international law. It's only the UN which is allowed, in theory, to put sanctions on a country, as sanctions were put on South Africa.
Of course, it's also economic warfare, isn't it? This is economic warfare.
It is, and of course, people die in economic warfare. At one stage, when there was a sort of eyeball to eyeball negotiation going on with the Argentinians about their international debt, the Americans said to them, "What do you think would happen to a country when they couldn't get insulin for their diabetics? So you better just cave in and do what we want." That's how they do business. But there's no basis in international law for any of that. And, of course, the Americans talk about a rules-based system. What they mean is our rules, and we don't even obey the rules that we set. International Criminal Court, for example, has decided that it is going to look into Israeli human rights abuses in the occupied territories, but the Americans are already saying that this is unfair to Israel and that, therefore, that it shouldn't go ahead. They're just not interested in playing by the rules.
The International Criminal Court seems to me like a bit of a bad joke. It only seems to criticise and arrest ethnic minority black African leaders. There's none of the Bushes and Blairs going through that international court. It's just another branch of the modern version of colonialism. But look, when I spoke to Peter Ford, he mentioned, didn't he, just now, about Bashar Assad and Asma Assad, the ruling couple in the country. And I thought it was quite interesting because he said, well, actually, they are pretty much like British people. They're very much, and he knew them, obviously got to know them as ambassador quite well. So I just asked him, you know, what were they like, Bashar Assad and his wife?
Bashar studied to be an eye doctor in London, and during his studies he met Asma, who's the daughter of a Syrian origin Harley Street surgeon, and she was a trainee banker herself. If you met her, you might even think she was English. She even looks like the traditional English rose, and she has a completely English accent.
Almost like a kind of English. if the British were behind the Civil War and behind the ruling party, well, isn't this a British problem? We often think about this as an American thing, Martin, but the Brits were definitely involved there, weren't they?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the British created, Syria and Iraq, and the Americans weren't directly involved in that. But then, of course, they've subsequently become the dominant players. And the Israelis, of course, constantly aggrandizing their position.
Also, I did speak to Peter about Russophobia, because Russia is really the only reason that country didn't slip away. There's all sorts of reasons why the Russians didn't want to see Syria fall. I think they realized that if that happened, that they were going to lose their Tartus base on the Mediterranean. But anyway, let's have a listen to what Peter had to say about Russophobia now.
Russia had the impertinence to want to have some sway in the Middle East, wanted to have one country, just one country, Syria, that wasn't under the thumb of the Western powers, because we've got all the other bases covered. Syria is absolutely surrounded. There is not a country in the Middle East except Syria, and of course Iran, but among Arab countries, not a country which is able to say no to America. And we could not tolerate not having the full monopoly board. Russia could not be allowed to have one country where it had more say than ourselves.
So have the Russians, do you think, successfully blocked that move, pretty much indefinitely now?
Well, the Russians have played their hand very cleverly. They're much smarter than we are. They think in much more strategic terms. Their language is always more polite than ours, but they're more calculating, and they know where their own real interests lie. We just have prejudices and obsessions.
Prejudices and obsessions, Martin. I mean, he's really saying there that as a diplomat, he felt that he was part of almost like a losing team, that the Russians were way more professional.
I think any objective observer would recognise that. I mean, look at the gyrations of policy that's been around Syria in the US, with the British just following along as the usual lapdog they are. Presumably when he was in post as a professional diplomat, they would be advising the politicians of things. But the politicians in the West are, overgrown kids, and they continually change policy, according to whims and prejudices. But underlying all of that is the will to power, the will to dominate, the idea that Fukuyama put in his book, The End of History, that everybody is going to become like the British and the Americans in the long run, and they've just got to get used to the idea. And, of course, the real world really isn't like that. And it's been a tragedy what's happened in Syria, totally unnecessary tragedy, which has caused millions of people to suffer extraordinary terror and misery. And it's actually funded by our taxes. And, of course, we then want to go home and have a nice cup of tea and pretend it's nothing to do with us.
Also, on antiwar.com, Israel are updating their plans to attack Iran, Martin, ready to act independently now, apparently. The Israeli Defense Minister, Benny Gantz, has told Fox News in an interview published just about a week ago, that the Israeli military is updating all its plans to strike Iran's nuclear program and is prepared to act independently. He portrayed Iran's recent steps to advance its civilian nuclear program as the Islamic Republic racing to develop the bomb.
Well, there's no real change there. They've been agitating for a war on Iran for a very long time. And, of course, we've still got all of these debates going on in Britain about who is and who is not an anti-Semite, which is just cover for a drive to war, a war which quite possibly is going to lead to the end of the world. But nevertheless, we've got plenty of Meghan Markle to talk about.
Well, you're going to love this because Peter Ford has some pretty strong views on what's going on with the royal family as well, Martin. But anyway, before we leave Israel, the United States, we just hear today, and Israel are holding their first strategic meeting on Iran, and that the Israelis Israel apparently has been attacking oil tankers since 2019, Iranian ones.
Yeah, well, also they assassinated that nuclear scientist, if you remember, and they continue to carry out sabotage operations of every kind inside Iran. Incidentally, just slightly off topic, the Americans have flagged up that they're going to carry out a cyber attack on Russia because they believe that Russia were behind this Solar Winds cyber attack inside the US. And they flagged it up and said, we're going to carry out an attack, cyber attack on Russia. Now, cyber attacks are illegal, but they've flagged up that they're going to carry one out.
Yeah, but they're acts of war as well.
Well, they are acts of war. And of course, what will happen at some point, if you keep provoking people, they eventually, the Russians are preparing for war. The Iranians.
Well, what with all our smartphones,
there's quite likely going to be one.
What with all our smart meters and our glorious Internet of Things, which is being pushed by Bristol City Council and the rest of them, you know, the usual suspects, what we're getting is incredibly vulnerable, aren't we? Things like our electricity supplies, the electrical power stations, our cars, our trains, all of our anything networks which are now dependent on computers are vulnerable to being destroyed in some sort of cyber attack, basically, at the very least, disabled completely.
Yeah, well, the Russians have been saying, well, why don't we get some conventions agreed about not doing any of those things? But the Stuxnet virus, the Israelis and the Americans openly boast, and no doubt the British were involved as well, caused all kinds of problems at Natanz for the Iranians, and then set off to poison computers all over the world, and may even have had something to do with what happened at Fukushima. The West is out of control. The deep state in the West is a war state, and they're basically gearing up for a confrontation, not just with minor powers, but with the two other major powers, China and Russia. And we're possibly going to have, we discussed in previous weeks COVID and whether it was a biological warfare attack on China or not. I'm quite certain that the Iranians, the Chinese and the Russians presume they're going to be attacked. And of course, they're going to wait. They're not just going to they don't do what the West does, which is send signals. That what they will do is when they retaliate, it will be overwhelming and they will do it by surprise.
Well, my main beef with the whole Meghan Markle story. Sorry, Martin, you can switch off if you want. But we're going to Peter Ford has got something to say about it all. Is that she offed her first husband of 2 years, Trevor Engelson. Then she offed her father, Thomas. Then she offed her brother, Thomas Markle Jr., and her sister, Samantha Markle, who's published a book, The Diary of a Princess, of Princess Pushy's sister, all about her. Meghan then went off to off the royal family too. Not to kill them, obviously, which is another word, but all I'm saying is that she just blanked them and she doesn't want anything to do with them. Maybe she doesn't like families. She's raised allegations about racism, mental health, passports and princes. And also, she seems to be trying to look like brave insider Princess Diana. Maybe, though, there's ulterior motives. I asked Peter Ford about this, whether he's a royalist or a Republican, and whether the events over the last week or so have changed his mind on that.
The Americans have an alternative royalty. It's called Hollywood. And Meghan kind of straddles the two rather interestingly. They have their Hollywood princesses and princes, and the Americans obsess about them just as we do about royalty. But the Americans got rid of the British royalty 2.5 centuries ago. They've not been anxious to reinvent that institution, though, as you mentioned, they do love their dynasties as well, their political dynasties, the Kennedys, the Clintons, the Rockefellers, etc. So, yeah, they also have a sort of instinct for it, but they've not brought back a monarchy.
What about the central allegation, really, in the Oprah Winfrey interview, which is related to racism and the idea that a young prince is not going to be called a prince? Would he actually get the chance to be called a prince? We don't know. And the idea that maybe it was going to be determined on his skin colour, that was the allegation anyway. Do you think that holds any water?
I think it's rather pathetic that anyone should be so attached to having their offspring be a prince. If Harry had any guts, he would have given up his title and become a Republican. That would have been interesting. But he's a nice chap. I like the way he came over in the interview, I must say. But I don't have much time for any of them. But that said, if you're going to have princes and princesses, then it's not fair that one should be excluded because they might be coffee colour.
But, I mean, are the royal family racists, Peter?
I've no idea. I haven't. I have actually met members of the royal family, but I've not discussed race with them. I got descended on by Prince Andrew when I was ambassador. That was a dreadful experience. You wouldn't want to be descended on by Andrew, and even worse, the courtiers, the staff. They are dreadful, snobbish, bossy, unbelievable, and living in not just in the last century, but 3 centuries ago in their attitudes. It wouldn't surprise me in the least that the courtiers were really racist.
What was it like being descended on by Andrew then? What happened?
Well, at the time, Andrew was supposed to be promoting British exports. So he came with a delegation of business people, and he was just so patronizing. He literally at one point patted me on the head. Unbelievable. I'm not a big fan. You probably sense that.
Okay, well, anyway, there's some big changes over in the States, allegedly. I mean, one does wonder, really, whether a change of president really means much of a change of policy. Sometimes it seems it doesn't. But what do you make of the new Biden administration? Do you think there'll be any changes internationally? I mean, obviously, the US, most of the American citizens will be voting on domestic policies, but the whole world is watching. What is this creature going to do next, America?
Well, American policy never changes much. Trump, bless his soul, tried very hard to change it. He ordered the withdrawal of Syria, of American forces from Syria, and twice he was countermanded by the real powers that be in America, the arms industry, the Pentagon, the security honchos, the diplomatic panjandrums, the Washington establishment, the Beltway, or the Blob, as some call it. And the Blob will continue to call the shots on American policy. Biden doesn't strike me as having the fiber of a man or the brain of a man who is going to shake things up. So it might... The branding will be a bit different. We'll hear more about human rights and all that nonsense. But there'll be no important changes of policy.
Well, it sounds like all that American election, Martin, was a complete waste of time.
Well, I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? The election is essentially a distraction, because whoever wins, the really serious policies are already decided. The selection of the candidates is fixed, and that's why Trump was so annoying for them, because he came from left. You know, when I say left field, he came from outfield, and he wasn't an insider. But ultimately, whatever he thought he was doing, he wasn't going to be allowed to do it. And Biden, of course, is very much the insider's insider, and it's not even going to cross his mind to rebel against what those people want. What's going to be very challenging is when Biden backs the Israelis on a war on Iran, Boris Johnson will no doubt go along with it, as will Dominic Raab, and we might even see Keir Starmer going along with it on the basis that Biden's in favour of it and Biden's one of the good guys. And, of course, that really will bring home the splits that are developing in the Labour Party between what I would call the pro-war faction and the genuinely anti-imperialist left in the party.
OK, well, so let's have a look now, move over to look a bit at the COVID pandemic or plandemic, depending on your party view on that. And we had some clips last week of an interview with Dr. Stanley Laham from Florida University, a long interview with him I did last week, which is up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk from last week, and I'll put it up again tonight. So much. He seems like an absolute goldmine of information. And one of the things he talked about we didn't have time for last week is this whole idea of using pandemics for biological warfare. So let's have a listen to that now.
The European population was more adapted to fight flu through natural selection in Europe, just like the Europeans who came to America had a better selective natural selection for smallpox than the indigenous population, and they tried to wipe out the indigenous population, of America with smallpox. They would give them as gift, sheets, clothing and cloth and stuff that from people who had died of smallpox. And as you know, the smallpox virus survives. It was a form of, biological warfare that was used against the American indigenous population. And sometimes intentionally and sometimes unintentionally. For example, when the Spaniards came to Hispaniola, they brought diseases that the Arawak Indians, what they call the Arawak Tainos, their immune system, these diseases did not exist in the Americas. Therefore, you did not have natural selection for a population that was resistant or had the capability to fight off those diseases.
Yeah, Stanley Laham there, talking about biological warfare in the Americas. Martin, this is actually quite well known. It should really be kind of prompting at least some of our news media, which, I mean, you probably find it's only online, this is really going on much, to be questioning about whether this is biological warfare, this pandemic.
Well, I mean, obviously, in previous weeks, we've covered this at great length. The fundamental difference is that there's a book called The Great Divide, which is about the difference between civilization in the Americas and in Eurasia. And what the really big difference that made a huge difference when the two civilizations met after 1492 was that in Eurasia, we'd had farm animals for thousands and thousands of years, all sorts of farm animals, and lots of diseases had come from those animals into the human population. And of course, they'd caused all sorts of pandemics. During the lockdown last year, I was reading loads of stuff about all of this. And it may well be that agriculture was invented with livestock was invented quite a few times in Eurasia. But of course, the problem with it was that it was rife with disease. But ultimately, of course, it became a successful setup where people, for example, developed lactose tolerance so that they could drink milk even as adults and so on. And it became a very successful way of doing things.
I thought I thought the diseases thrived. One of the ways that they thrived was through mass urbanization and that sort of thing that was going on in Eurasia.
Yes, that's right. But you had urbanization in the Maya, the Mexica, the Incas had urban civilization, but they didn't have farm animals apart from llamas, and that meant that they didn't have any immunity to the diseases that came.
Well,
from
that's a bit of a shame because llamas are very antisocial creatures.
Because they're antisocial creatures, they were hardly used for anything, so they didn't really have much of an interaction with them. So they, even if they had developed diseases from llamas, there's possibly some llama diseases that they were exposed to, but that didn't help them at all.
But I mean, one of the main points that come from
cows and sheep and goats.
One of the main points I think is really fascinating that Stanley's making in this, which you can download from last week's show page or this week's tonight, is he's talking about the extent to which immunity is passed down through generations through the mother, both through genetics, in other words, so that your immune system is adapting over long periods of time and natural selection to actually being able to cope with certain types of diseases and not others, but also a fascinating conversation with him, which is gets a bit technical, which is why I'm not using it tonight, about the extent to which a mother actually passes immunity from antigens and blood cells on through the placenta into the child. So there's all sorts of important things here where, you know, inherited immunity through natural selection and also through genetics through antigens passed into the child. But of course, the problem is, as he goes into in great depth, is the different blood groups. So, you know, you've got a potentially a mother with one blood group and a child, an embryo with a different blood group. So there has to be a big separation between the two. But the point he's making really here, Martin, is that if you work with the body's immune system, say, for example, you're using something like ivermectin to give the body's immune system a chance to fight off COVID-19, or if you're allowing someone to catch it and also develop the a mild version or whatever so that they can then fight it off into the future, that is potentially carried on to future generations. Whereas if you have a vaccine, that doesn't pass on to any future generations at all. It's only for the one person.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because I have, in fact, been vaccinated this week with AstraZeneca vaccine. There are wider scientific questions about vaccination, immune systems, and so on. And then there's the big question, which we, you know, you began this section, was, is this biological warfare? And I suspect that some people know whether it is or it isn't. We certainly heard the Murdoch press and others pushing the idea that it was definitely the Chinese, that's why they call it the Chinese virus and all the rest of it. And I suspect rather to the opposite, that it is in fact a biological warfare attack on China.
This is just not accurate. I mean, the Murdoch press, as you call it, Fox News, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, was actually pushing that this was a US virus actually manufactured in Wuhan.
That is very interesting. The work done by that journalist, which we've covered in previous weeks, is very interesting. But that's not the main line that was being taken by the Murdoch press in Australia, for example. They were basically just trying to pin it on the Chinese. I mean, of course, they're trying to suggest that it's incompetence by the Chinese and in their laboratory.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, things have moved on.
That were actually based in the US, as you said.
In the last month or 6 weeks, things have moved on with Steve Hilton and the Next Revolution program, really taking things on quite a long way. Yeah. And other parts of the Murdoch empire have been reporting that, although rather sceptical, I think, is sceptical about it, but at least reporting it. So it's incredible to see Murdoch doing this as somebody who I've been a great disliker of for decades, and I'm sure most of our listeners have. Incredible to see Murdoch doing that. But anyway, look, let's have a listen now again to another clip from Stanley Laham
And this is really looking at a very serious topic, and that is that whether the protocols that have been being devised by our government health departments, both in the US, in Britain and elsewhere, these protocols have been preventing doctors from actually treating patients properly and ultimately killing people. So these faulty protocols, and, you know, he and I were discussing at the end of the interview, we have to find out who's written these protocols, if it means that potentially tens of thousands of people have died because of those protocols, and that the pandemic has been made far, far worse because the wrong protocols for treatment have been prescribed for doctors within the National Health Service, for example, that they have to do. And he was saying, as you're just about to hear, how it is basically in a situation where he as a doctor is diagnosing somebody, they go into hospital, he loses control of the patient, and then they die. So have these protocols being used in our hospitals been killing patients? Let's have a listen to that now from Stanley.
Across the world, a lot of people are using ivermectin. For example, I know of four countries that put it in their protocol to treat, SARS-CoV-2, and they have very low mortality. Very, very low mortality.
So which countries are those?
All right. El Salvador, Honduras, India has started the same, distributing ivermectin. By the way, preventatively, as a preventive, because it's a comparatively very cheap drug compared to remdesivir. Not quite as cheap as chloroquine, but close. The Dominican Republic, and now Haiti. The first country that I was aware of that was using remdesivir as national policy was Honduras. Then came El Salvador, and I'm sure there are others that I don't know about.
I mean, so how can it be that something which is a cheap, well, it's not a cure, but it's certainly, there's statistics are around 75% recovery rates, you know, up a bit, some a bit more, some a bit less, using ivermectin. How come Haiti has got it right and Europe and the United States have got it wrong?
It's very funny. Money, it has to have to be with money. The American public, I don't know if it's the same in England, but the American public is the most exploited as far as the health industry is concerned. It's because remdesivir cost, the cost of treatment of remdesivir is about $12,000 in hospital. That's what your insurance company, or you personally, if you don't have insurance, or if you're old enough that your Medicare has to pay for. And do you know how they justified it? Do you know how Dr. Fauci, Anthony Fauci, justified that cost? Not because the cost of production is high, but because they say, according to their research, it reduces hospital stay by 3 days. Look at the original publication on why remdesivir was recommended. It reduces hospital stay by 3 to 4 days, which I don't think it has, but they say it has. It hasn't saved lives, obviously. Those who were critically ill, we wouldn't have that high of mortality among hospital patients. And they said $12,000 is less than 3 or 4 additional days in hospital in the U.S. And I have my cousin's brother, well, he's my cousin through marriage, who died here at Baptist Hospital after 3 weeks on respirator and remdesivir. And that's why I told my... And this was back in July. And that's why 2 months ago, when my friend here, I told her, do not go to the doctor. You go to the hospital. Once you're in, I cannot tell you what to take. And I remember when my cousin's brother was in hospital, we were talking to his wife, and whenever she would call the hospital, she was not allowed in back in July. People were in total isolation, and they would tell her that we're following CDC recommendation. And I'll never forget, the week before he died, 3 days before he died, they said they think he's doing better. 3 days later, he was dead. And he had a full course of remdesivir for the, to the cost of $12,000.
Now, that's a lot of money, isn't it? And cousin's brother is dead, Martin. So some of these protocols seem to be being drawn up by the drug companies.
Well, I think that's it's pretty obvious that the Western setup, particularly in the United States of America, is completely corrupt.
But wait, hang on, we've been using the same here. It doesn't, Martin, we've been using the same sort of protocols here, haven't we?
Yeah, but I mean, the US is a worse. I mean, the public health system in the US is by many times worse than the one we have here. But what's happened with the NHS is it's been run down and undermined in all sorts of different ways, but it's still a fundamentally much better organised system in principle than what happens in the US.
And that doesn't really matter, does it? It doesn't matter who's paying for it in a way, whether it's the patient that dies because of a bad protocol or the government that pays for the patient here that dies under a bad protocol. It's the protocol that's the problem and the pharmaceutical lobby that's drawing it up.
Well, I agree, but the pharmaceutical lobby has a great deal of too much power in this country, but it's got even more power in the United States of America, and that's fundamental.
Well, yes, and
the vaccine rollout in Britain has been relatively successful because it's been run by the NHS. And that's because the NHS, despite being run down, is quite an efficient system for doing stuff like that.
Well, it also may be, Martin, because people trust the NHS more. I noticed the vaccines haven't gone down too well in France. There's been quite a lot of people. They say they're vaccine hesitant. Well, you know, I'm not vaccine hesitant. I'm vaccine intelligent. I don't think I need a vaccine, partly because I believe I've already had COVID-19. And secondly, because I think that the other sorts of treatments that Stan is recommending, the antiviral treatments, which allow you to build up some resistance to it and not die, and also to pass that resistance on potentially to future generations, if you're a woman, that's a better way of dealing with things. But anyway, let's have a listen to Stanley again. And he's explaining here how he believes we're paying the price. The public is paying the price for this pandemic in two different ways.
Well, that's regrettable. It's regrettable that we're in such a state of affairs. And I think the public is paying the price two ways. First of all, financially, because the public money that's being paid to these companies, the billions for their vaccines, is from our tax money. And second, we're paying with it with our lives, because some of these, ivermectin could have saved perhaps thousands of lives.
At much less of the cost as well. He also, Martin, I want to ask you to pay attention particularly this time, because he completely disagrees with you when it comes to lockdowns. He thinks that the lockdowns have proven to be a disaster. So it'd be interesting to see what you've got to say after our final clip from Dr. Stanley Laham, who's a retired immunologist. He seems to – I actually joked with him saying, well, it's like you're taking us on a trip of the immune system, a bit like the Fantastic Voyage – the film where these people get miniaturized and stuck inside someone's body, and they're kind of seeing all the corpuscles, the white blood cells, the red blood cells. He does that for me. He's given me a fantastic insight into what's going on with the immune system. But here he is, and we'll let you have what you have to say about lockdowns afterwards, Martin, where he says that the lockdowns are proven to be a total disaster.
Well, this is perhaps, to me, the biggest mistake in combating the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic. COVID-19, anybody who says, well, we did the best we could and we were successful, is inherently wrong, because look what it has done. Look how many shutdowns. Look how, for a coronavirus that has a mortality rate of 1% at most. And the reason for that is that we've been concentrating, one of the reasons for that, we've been concentrating on protocols that seem to be effective against all other viruses except those that the coronavirus for which they were designed. Supposedly that's why we're not seeing all the flu epidemics or pandemics, because these measures were effective against the flu but not against the corona for which they were designed. So that's a failure. And second, we've been concentrating on vaccines for a virus that's presenting mutations with antigenic structures that do not cross-react, so that a vaccine, we might get an antigenic variant of the coronavirus for which the vaccine you receive is only 20% effective. There is cross-reaction, but very little. So what we should, I think, have concentrated on as much as vaccines, which nobody has funded, I have heard of no government funding for it, is on antiviral drugs. Something that would keep the coronavirus from replicating. Now, it so happened that we found out that a drug that was first elaborated in 1975 by a Japanese scientist called ivermectin is very effective in inhibiting the replication of the coronavirus in vitro, that is, in tissue cultures, and in people, in vivo. I told you that my friends were, two of them that were, and that got for sure infection with SARS-CoV-2, did very well with ivermectin supplemented with an antibiotic and high doses of course, vitamin C and vitamin D, which is also as important. And there's a history of finding antiviral drugs, you know, by accident. One of the best is, for example, the simple amino acid L-lysine against all types of herpes virus, from herpes type 1 causing fever blisters to herpes simplex 2 causing genital herpes or mononucleosis. But for example, we found that L-lysine, a simple amino acid, inhibits the growth of herpes viruses, just like we found that hydrochloroquine inhibits to a certain extent the replication of the coronavirus. So does ivermectin. We found drugs that inhibit the retroviruses, which I mentioned before, things like actinomycin D, rifampin, AZT. We could have concentrated on finding simple molecules that inhibit the coronavirus. Now, the one antiviral that was heralded as effective and that made Gilead Pharmaceuticals close to $10 billion, and the chief executives of who promptly sold a lot of their shares to personally make a lot of money, was remdesivir.
So there he is, Martin. He's saying, look, it's made $10 billion getting this on the protocol. But also the more important point is that lockdowns, this whole system of lockdowns has really not stopped SARS-CoV-2, but it has stopped flu. You know, so he's saying that the lockdown protocols or whatever they're doing with the lockdowns has simply failed.
Well, I think you've got to unpack various aspects of this. I'm totally willing to accept that there may well be cheaper antiviral drugs which have not been looked at because of the overweening power of the pharmaceutical companies. I'm not going to get into it. I don't know enough about ivermectin. It may be so that, as he says, he's a doctor. I'm willing to listen to what he's got to say. Now, what he said about lockdowns, the countries which lock down early and hard have no COVID, virtually none. And that's nothing to do with ivermectin or vaccines or anything. They used straightforward administrative measures, track and trace. They squeeze the virus out, and their economies, and we're talking particularly about the Chinese economy, is going to be the only economy last year in growth. And that, of course, is we're dealing with World War III, as we were discussing in an earlier part of the programme. That means that the Western powers, with what they've done, they've allowed this to happen because there's lots of disaster capitalism, because that's the way the West is organised. But it may well be that the deep state in the West wanted COVID to be a disaster in the way that it is, so that they could bring in the Great Reset and all the rest of it. The problem with that is that the Chinese have checkmated them. And, of course, that's what World War III is going to be about.
Okay, so the former Syrian ambassador, Peter Ford, I also spoke to him about what he made of the lockdown policies to do with the COVID-19 hysteria or pandemic, depending on how you see it. So let's have a listen now to our final clip with Peter Ford. After just hearing our last clip with Dr. Stanley Laham, Peter Ford now on what he makes of these COVID lockdowns.
Well, I'm utterly opposed to lockdown. I think as a strategy, it's absolutely disproportionate and it doesn't even work. I was tempted to describe myself as a lockdown skeptic, but in my case, it's a lot deeper than skepticism. It's outright opposition. I have been on demonstrations, on marches in London, Liverpool, Manchester. I have fought the good fight on this issue, risking arrest several times and still campaigning very vigorously. I'm utterly opposed to lockdown. I think the curtailment of our liberties is absolutely shocking. Even Mao Zedong would have been shocked by how far we've gone controlling even intimate family behavior, that you need the permission of a policeman to go 2 miles down the road and have a coffee. Unbelievable and unforgivable. Unforgivable. I'm particularly struck by the obsession of our masters with so-called models. They don't want to look at the real world, as you mentioned, the examples of Sweden, Florida, South Dakota, Belarusia, several countries in the developing world, including Syria. Almost everywhere has done better than us. We've had the most strict lockdown, and we've suffered most in terms of fatalities and in terms of the dreadful damage to our economies and jobs.
That's the final clip from Peter Ford, Martin. As he says, he's not a sceptic. He's in absolute opposition to lockdowns.
Well, I don't agree. I think the Chinese have got it right. I think the Vietnamese have got it right. I think the New Zealanders have got it right. And they're not using vaccines or ivermectin. And they've actually, their economies are growing. What happened here is that they took their eye off the ball and they were worried about other things, mentioning Brexit again.
So do you think it's okay to, this has this whole sort of zero COVID policy. I mean, it's not going to work, is it, if the whole world doesn't adopt it, this zero COVID policy? It may be that there's very little, if any, COVID flying around in places like New Zealand. But unless the whole world does that, it's surely pointless. At some point, someone is going to come to New Zealand and the whole thing is going to start over again, isn't it? Or China or wherever.
Well, what's actually happening is a Southeast Asian bloc is developing before our eyes of zero COVID states. And they are going to be the winners in the 21st century, provided they're not prevented from winning by a war directed at them. And of course, it may well be that this is a biological warfare attack on China, which has massively backfired. But the economic impact is quite clear. Nobody is going to be allowed into China, New Zealand, Vietnam or Taiwan, any of these countries, unless they are COVID free. And that means either having a vaccine or having been vaccinated. And this is going to go on and on and on and on, because we're moving into a wartime economy now. That's where we're at. And the banking system is on the verge of collapse. The stock market at some point will go down, and the countries which are well organized will manage. And the countries like this one, we're in Britain, where we're run by incompetents and fools by any definition, we are going to do very badly.
As regards to lockdown, there's going to be some relaxing of the rules Saturday, 13th of March. Martin, are you going to be taking advantage of them, or are you going to be locking yourself down?
Well, I'm prepared to go along with whatever is agreed and everybody and you know, what the general policy is. As I say, I've had my first vaccination. I've got another one in some months' time, but I'm going to work anyway. I'm working in schools and, in theory, possibly being exposed. It's a bit.
What's the testing regime for people working in schools like you?
Well, I mean, in January, we were being tested. The staff were being tested once a week. In the school I'm in now, there is no testing going on, but there's quite a lot of restrictions still in place. And, you know, I'm becoming an elderly gentleman, and I've got high blood pressure, and I potentially would be in a risk category. So when the opportunity to get a vaccine came up, and of course this is the AstraZeneca vaccine, it could have been the Pfizer vaccine, which I'm much more cautious about. And of course that has been produced at cost, as has the Sputnik vaccine, as has the Cuban vaccine, as has the Chinese vaccine. None of them produced by Western pharmaceutical companies, not for profit.
You've got to have a second jab, have you?
You know what they did when they were developing the AstraZeneca vaccine in Oxford University. They discovered by accident that in actual fact you give people two jabs rather than one. It's actually with a smaller dose each time. It's more effective than just one dose. So that's why they're doing it like that. And of course, they originally, you were supposed to have the second vaccine dose 3 weeks after the first. But because they didn't have enough doses, they're now going on for the 12-week. You know, it'll be some weeks away before you get a second dose. And, I'm not particularly keen on it, but I just thought, well, there isn't really much of an option. And of course, what will happen, it's quite clear that if things like Glastonbury go ahead, then they're going to have everybody with vaccine passports. Otherwise, they won't be allowed to go ahead. That's probably what will happen.
Well, news just come through today about your vaccine, Martin, unfortunately. It's to do with blood clot reports in Europe prompt an investigation into the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. The jab has been suspended because of reports of blood clots in vaccinated Italy. I think it's just one batch of them, though. I'm not absolutely sure. Thailand is also delaying the AstraZeneca rollout after the European countries have suspended that vaccine over these deaths due to blood clot fears. And here in the UK, we've also got, you know, questions about that too. The regulator says it's safe, but in other parts of the world, Denmark and Norway and Iceland have all temporarily halted the use of all AstraZeneca vaccinations to investigate reports of blood clots amongst people who've had the jab.
Well, countries like Iceland, which are COVID-free through using lockdown, they can take their time to decide whether they want to use a vaccine. The reason it's been rushed out here is because they've made so many mistakes, lockdowns that didn't work because they were too late, lifted too early, eat out to spread out, that the vaccine is really the only, they've bet the farm on that. And if it transpires that the vaccine, but the real danger with it probably is that it's not going to work. And they're not using it in South Africa either, because it doesn't work on the South African variant. And of course, if the South African variant is brought back into the US, all the people have been vaccinated, it'll be no good anyway.
Well, I'll tell you what does work on the South African variant, ivermectin. So despite the ban, they say UK's Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, the MHRA, said there's no evidence to suggest AstraZeneca vaccine is the cause of the blood clots. Are you confident in this MHRA?
Well, I've had the AstraZeneca one, not the Pfizer one. So the Pfizer one is more problematic because it's much more expensive.
Well, we know that from past weeks, but this week there seems to be some big questions about the vaccine you've had, Martin.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, they've rushed these vaccines through because they don't want to look at other alternatives. If you suggested ivermectin, I'm not hostile to people talking about stuff like that. If that's the case, then let's hear about it. But what gets me about people who are, critical of the policies that have been pursued is that it's a rag bag of stuff. Lockdown clearly has worked in some countries and not in others, especially where it hasn't been properly pursued. Why argue about face masks? It seems to me that's a secondary issue altogether.
I mean, there's an obvious flaw in what you're saying, is that if lockdowns have worked, how come we've had to keep redoing them time and time again for a whole year?
Because they haven't done them properly, Tony. We didn't lock down till too late. Then we released too early. We did it again. We've done it three times. Eventually, you learn through your mistakes or you don't learn. In countries where they got on with it properly, a proper test and trace system, like in China, unlike Dido Harding wasting £37 billion, then they've managed to do it. What this has been is a really, really acid test of the way in which countries are organised and how well organised they are or are not. The Southeast Asians have come out with flying colours. The neoliberal West, including Western and Eastern Europe and Russia, to be fair, have come out very badly. And it's pretty clear who's done it right and who's done it wrong
at this stage of the game. I mean, for what it's worth, I think that you're wrong on that, because there's been also successful non-lockdown countries. So the worst thing you can do is to actually vacillate and do a bit of one and a bit of the other, which is what, you're right, the British have done and the Americans have done. But anyway, we're going to move on now to look at Adam Curtis. Now, I know you mentioned this to me a few weeks ago, this new series. I mean, I've just been looking at it and I think that I'm really disappointed in this documentary. I always look forward to thinking, well, at least there's somebody producing decent documentaries which are going out, being produced by the BBC these days. But this is an absolutely appalling film. What it does is it looks at the JFK conspiracy theories as the sort of root of all evil. And yeah, as we know, this is almost like the CIA commissioned this documentary from Adam Curtis. What is, you know, because as you and I know, it was the CIA themselves that came out with this term conspiracy theory in order to squash any proper investigation of the JFK assassination in the years after that. In the mid and late 1960s, this was their term that they would use to smear anybody that was getting close to finding the truth about what had happened to JFK. So what do you make of this whole idea of the conspiracy theory? And because it seems to be one of those little expressions that is a meme that's going around the whole of the Western media. Basically, conspiracy theorists are painted as mad people, where actually what they're doing, what we're doing, is trying to get to the truth.
Well, as you say, the term conspiracy theory is used in the mainstream media, originated in the 1960s in the United States. It was CIA's term, because up to that point, the theories about the assassination of JFK were called assassination theories. And one of the things that the psychological warfare people in the CIA decided to do was to use the term conspiracy theory to cover these things. Now, I've watched the whole, it's a very long series of films that he's made. They're over an hour long, and each of them about an hour and a half, and there's six of them. So I watched them all, and what I found about it is there's lots of detail in there which I don't agree with, and there's loads of stuff that's not in there which I would imagine ought to have been in there. So in many respects, it's actually a bit of a curate's egg of a series. But what he has done, and I think which is worth watching if you're interested, is he's got access to the BBC archive, and there's loads of really interesting archive footage in there of all sorts of different things from all over the world. which very rarely gets seen.
No, but he's
put them all together. Yeah, and whatever you think of his overall thesis, the clips themselves are intrinsically interesting.
Well, I mean, it seems to me perfect Orwellian stuff. He's been given access to the BBC archives in order to try and turn history on its head. But let's have a listen now to the first clip from this. We've got a couple of short clips, luckily not the sort of whatever it is, 12 hours or something you're describing, Martin. And the first one is from the first episode where he starts getting into how terrible it is to question the JFK assassination.
Kerry Thornley had left California and gone to live in New Orleans, where he worked in a bar. The movement that he and his friend Greg Hill had started, Discordianism, was beginning to grow, spreading by word of mouth. Like much of the new counterculture, it was against all politics. It distrusted all the old systems of power, left and right, because they were just trying to force you into their version of reality. Thornley also published his novel, with Lee Harvey Oswald as the central figure. It was called The Idle Warriors. But New Orleans was also the city where Lee Harvey Oswald had lived before the Kennedy assassination. And as a result, Thornley came to the notice of the man who was going to be the main creator of the JFK conspiracy theory. He was the district attorney of New Orleans, called Jim Garrison. Garrison said that Oswald had just been part of a giant conspiracy that included the CIA, big business, the news media, and anti-Castro Cubans, who together had killed the president.
There's no question about that. There was a conspiracy. A number of men were involved. An apparatus which was lethal in nature, of which Lee Harvey Oswald was a part, assigned a role essentially as decoy. Now, don't ask me what the organization is, because I can't say.
But the implication clearly is the Central Intelligence Agency, your own security organization in the United States.
It almost sounds like that, doesn't it? I have no comment about that.
Jim Garrison believed that the modern democratic system in America was just a facade. That behind it was another secret system of power that really controlled the country. But you could never discover it through normal means, because it was so deeply hidden. Garrison wrote a memo to his staff explaining how you could uncover this secret world. He called it time and propinquity. You didn't bother with meaning or with logic, he said, because that will always be hidden. Instead, you look for patterns, strange coincidences and links that may seem to have no meaning, but are actually telltale signs on the surface of the hidden system of power underneath. This theory was going to have a very powerful effect in the future, because it would lead to a profound shift in how many people understood the world. Because what it said was that in a dark world of hidden power, you couldn't expect everything to make sense. That it was pointless to try and understand the meaning of why something happened, because that would always be hidden from you. What you looked for were the patterns. And when Garrison read Kerry Thornley's novel, he saw a pattern. Not only had Thornley been in the Marines with Oswald and written a novel about him, but he had come to live in the same city that Oswald had lived in before the assassination. And in 1967, Garrison accused Thornley of being part of the conspiracy. Thornley was furious. He knew that Garrison was wrong. But he also hated the very idea of conspiracy theories. He believed that they were one of the ways those in power controlled you. Conspiracy theories made you believe that there were hidden forces that really controlled the world. And that made you as an individual feel weak and powerless. Suspicion, he believed, was just another form of control.
Well, suspicion is another form of control. So he was saying you shouldn't be suspecting that there was a secret system there. It's interesting. I think that Adam Curtis runs through these various parts of the system that Jim Garrison was suggesting were behind the Kennedy assassination, the CIA, big business, particularly the Texas oil barons, the mass media, the news media, he calls it there, and the anti-Castro Cubans. Well, as we know, this is exactly who was behind the Kennedy assassination. It certainly wasn't the Russians who, with the idea of having Oswald as the shooter, the idea was to try and pin it on the Russians, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, I think what the thing about Adam Curtis is that what he does is he goes into all sorts of stuff that the mainstream by and large ignores. And he's one of the few people who's allowed to do it. But, I mean, if you compare what he's done to what Frankovich did with his documentaries for the Time Watch series about Gladio, is that it's all Curtis is very interested in what you might call sociology of conspiracy and why people believe conspiracies. I mean, in other parts of the films, he says, well, of course, there are conspiracies. You know, the Americans have been involved in overthrowing democratic governments, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, in other words,
but not their own.
What he is he's a limited hangout merchant. That's what he is. He raises all the questions.
Okay, but what do you make?
And also the tone of voice he adopts there. It's like it's not quite as bad as the Conspiracy Files, but we're getting there. And
yeah,
that's presumably, as you say,
getting very close. Actually, I mean, he's done some terrific stuff in the past. The Century of the Self, The Power of Nightmares, for example. It's just a pity to see him selling out in this way. But he talks about the Discordians there. Who are these guys?
Well, the guy who they're the ones who pushed this idea, you know, Robert Anton Wilson and the Illuminati novel trilogy and so on. So he thinks that the main fault I would put on Adam Curtis is he sees everything as to do with mind control and people's minds. And in actual fact, a lot of conspiracy is actually physical stuff. It's shooting people, it's poisoning people and stuff like this, you know. He's always interested in the way in which people perceive things. And that, of course, there's a lot of visual richness in the films because he's got all of this archive footage that he's obviously spent a long time editing together. But he's also I get rather irritated by his tone of voice. Because it's
he's saying.
He can explain everything and everybody else is stupid. And of course, a lot of detail is just wrong.
He's always had that style. He's veered, as you say, towards this kind of conspiracy files. It seems like, you know, he wants to kind of pick and choose his conspiracies. Some exist, some don't. The secret system, if you want, the hidden government, the parallel government. The secret government, but he seems to pick on the wrong ones to discredit. But anyway,
well, he just doesn't take conspiracy seriously enough.
Yeah,
what he does is he says, you've got the people over here who believe 9/11 was a conspiracy. You've got people over here that believe that Trump was working with the Russians. He thinks that's a load of nonsense. And of course, he presents himself as somebody who's not taken in by any of this. We all know that all these conspiracies are wrong, apart from the ones which are right. But of course, he doesn't specify those.
Yeah,
apart
so
from
the United
ones that we know about anyway. You know.
So the CIA go around, fixing governments, killing, assassinating, but they would never ever think and dream of doing it to JFK. I mean, it's just not credible. But anyway, let's have a listen to the second and final clip, a short one now, about the Discordians, a bit more about them and Robert Anton Wilson.
He and Greg Hill began by placing a false letter in the Playboy letters page. Thornley's fake letter asked whether all the political assassinations in America were really being masterminded by a single secret society, and the society it named was the Illuminati. It said that the Illuminati were behind all the chaos and the fear that was now gripping America. He and the other Discordians then proceeded to spread this idea all across America through the counterculture, in magazines and books, and even in plays. Thornley's aim was to try and break the spell of conspiracy theories by making people see the absurdity of believing them. And he had chosen the Illuminati for the experiment because no one could possibly believe that an 18th century organization from Bavaria was really, in the second half of the 20th century, the secret rulers of the modern world. It was clearly ridiculous.
Or was it? You know, these secret societies can sometimes continue for long periods of time. And I thought we'd have a listen, Martin, to a clip with Alistair Milne and Duncan Campbell from the 1980s. These two got together. Duncan Campbell did a series for the BBC called Secret Society. It was looking at the incredible amount of secrecy that does go on in Britain. And of course, the hint in the background is to do with things like the Illuminati or Freemasonry, using this term secret society to describe what goes on in the UK. There were two major programmes as part of that series which were banned, not by the BBC itself, but through the Board of Governors, by the government and by the Ministry of Defence. One of them was about secret cabinet committees, saying that a lot of the decisions that were being made by the government were completely away from any kind of scrutiny, made by appointees. Important decisions like whether or not to have a Trident nuclear submarine replacement was being made by a secret society within the cabinet, or an offshoot of the cabinet. The other one was about the Zircon spy satellite and how vast amounts of money were being spent on a spy satellite, and tactics had been used by the Ministry of Defence in order to make sure that there was no understanding or scrutiny of that through Parliament. So very successful attempts, particularly to do with things which might be regarded as militarily sensitive, to make sure that not a single parliamentarian had any access to those decisions, that they were basically being made in secret. So let's have a listen to this now. This is the Secret Society series that Duncan Campbell produced and presented for the BBC in the 1980s. And here is Duncan talking about the way he was sacked by the BBC, the Director General Alistair Milne was, because of this series. And of course, this, for anyone that understands these things, marked really the beginning of the end of the BBC as an independent force. It's now controlled by the City of London through appointees to the chairman of the Board of Governors from the city, from big city institutions, as if they would make any good at running a journalistic organisation. They're just there to make sure that their criminal activities in the City of London don't get investigated. And the Director Generals that we have now, equally appalling. For example, I mean, probably the last decent one was Greg Dyke. They're now, Tim Davey, the most recent Director General, is one of the marketing people from PepsiCo. So we're really getting an absolute monstrosity taking over, with the City of London criminals chairing the BBC and the marketing people from Pepsi making all the editorial decisions day to day. So let's have a listen to this discussion from the 1980s between Duncan Campbell, the investigative journalist behind the Secret Society series, and the Director General of the BBC, Alistair Milne, the father of Seamus Milne, who was the Jeremy Corbyn's press secretary, who was Director General at the time, who commissioned that series, and that was then sacked in 1987.
Cabinet wasn't the first programme in the Secret Society series to suffer this fate. When the contents of another episode, Zircon, were revealed, the results were rather more dramatic.
Once inside, the detectives began a lengthy search.
The Zircon program had revealed the secret plan for Britain to launch its own spy satellite. Special Branch searched my house, looking for evidence of a leak. The New Statesman magazine published the Zircon story. Its turn came next. The police search lasted 5 days. The BBC's Scottish headquarters in Glasgow were next on the list. The Special Branch were ordered to remove every tape, film, script and scrap of paper for secret society. Despite a month of extensive police activity, most of the BBC's films and tapes were soon returned. 9 months later, it was announced that there would be no charges over the Zircon affair. The Zircon film itself was returned to the BBC at the end of 1987 and transmitted a year later. There was no outcry. But the Cabinet programme has never been seen on television until tonight. So what was the fuss about?
I didn't think it was a brilliant piece of work, but it contained some very good things. I saw nothing wrong with it in terms of transmission.
But okay to go out in the air?
Absolutely, no problem, yeah.
Secret Society brought to a head a long-running row between the BBC governors and Alasdair Milne. They didn't like being under fire from the government, and they didn't like the kind of people Milne was letting work for the BBC.
One of them described you as a destroyer, and there was a lot of worrying and huffing and puffing, particularly when Hussey arrived. I was determined that if we were going to have a showdown with the board again after Real Lives, that it wouldn't just be one voice, but all the editorial power that we could bring to bear on it.
You'd written to the governors to say you'd approved five and put one aside, and then this was announced. And then something rather catastrophic happened.
The next board meeting on January the 29th, there was a bit more huffing and puffing about Secret Society, but the decision had been made. As far as I was concerned, it had anyway. But at the end of that board meeting, I was called in by the chairman and the vice chairman and told that I was to leave immediately. And so I left the BBC that very day on the 29th of January 1987, while the special branch were just about to launch their attack on Broadcasting House in Glasgow.
In your autobiography, you talk about being hounded by the governors in your last weeks in the BBC. What was going on?
The governors, as I say, a number of them disapproved of the BBC hiring you anyway. They were extremely tense about the possible outcome of the individual programmes. They raised the issue at every board meeting till I went. And they were pretty grumpy about the whole thing. Hounding is, I think, a fair description. Over a period of time, the governors had been appointed from a particular spectrum of the political world.
The that spectrum is, being?
The ruling Conservative Party.
It had nothing to do with me. It's only a matter for the BBC.
Did he resign because of political pressure, Mrs. Thatcher?
No, only a matter for the BBC.
But Mrs. Thatcher didn't seem unhappy about the peremptory manner in which the governors had disposed of their Director General.
I was furious. I mean, apart from the fact it was a very considerable shock. I was just very, very angry because I don't believe people should be treated like that. And there must be better, more elegant ways of parting company than simply being called in and thrown out in your ear, no?
So that's the voice of the late Alasdair Milne, who's Director General of the BBC in 1987, who was booted out for this Secret Society series, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, that is what I would call bona fide 100% conspiracy theory about specific things, specific people, specific, focused journalistic investigation. General theories about generalities of the control by, the political system by a secret society descended from the 18th century. Well, I've got much less time for that sort of argument, full stop.
Yeah, but the point really I'm trying to make here, I suppose, is we've come a long way down the road from 1987. That decision to remove Alasdair Milne has had enormous consequences, leaving us now with a system which is completely in the hands of commercial big business and the City of London.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting to see how things develop going forward. The BBC quite clearly is, insofar as it's got any independence left at all, they're in many respects pursuing the government's line on various things. And of course, at the same time, we've got Murdoch's going to bring in his version, some other TV station, and Andrew Neil also is talking of doing the same. We're going to move to a more US style system where the commercial interests of big business will be dominant, and the public sphere that the BBC at its best has represented will be consistently marginalised and undermined.
Yeah, and journalism will be dead. Anyway, so we're going to look finally now at the go-betweens for Hitler, and that is because of the Meghan Markle interview. I know how much you love this story, Martin, but I thought rather than look at that, we'd look at the parallels with the abdication scandal back in 1936. Just looking at the timeline of this, I think is fascinating because you've got to see the whole thing in context. What happened with Edward and Mrs. Simpson? You had King Edward VIII, who'd only just taken over from King George V. And all of a sudden, he was out on his ear. Basically, the guy was a very enthusiastic pro-Nazi. And, of course, that wasn't really going to work. A bit embarrassing in the run-up to World War II, almost embarrassing as it was in World War I, that the royal family had to change their name from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor in order to, I suppose, con the British people into thinking that they weren't Germans. So there's a bit of embarrassment there. And the fact that the First World War really was just a family squabble between three cousins who fell out. That is to say, Kaiser Wilhelm, King George V, and Tsar Nicholas, who were all cousins, fell out and caused the First World War. The incredible stuff that Karina Urbach has brought out in her 2015 book, which is called Go-Betweens for Hitler, is pretty fascinating. But we're going to try and set it in context tonight here, because it was in January 1936 that King George V died and Edward VIII came to the throne. Then, later that year, in December 1936, Edward VIII abdicated and became the Duke of Windsor, with running off with Mrs. Simpson. There was a big crisis. She was a divorcee, and supposedly, due to the law, she wasn't allowed to marry the king. Well, that has happened with Prince Charles, of course, and actually people have questioned whether Charles and Camilla's marriage is actually legal, because the law states that the royal family have got to have different basic rules about whether they can be married to divorcees or not than the rest of us. And then the next year, in June 1937, Edward married Mrs. Simpson, who'd managed to get her divorce properly through over in France. In October 1937, the Duke of Windsor did a tour of Nazi Germany, organised by a guy who's a fascinating person in this book, Go-Betweens for Hitler, called Charlie Coburg. And he seems to be a sort of almost Desmond Morton, Martin Bormann-style character for the royals, making sure that there are connections continuing between the Nazis and the top of the British establishment. So that's October 1937, as the Duke of Windsor with Mrs. Simpson does a tour of Nazi Germany, with all, of course, the marvellous publicity that there is here for Germany, which comes as a result. Then on the 10th of May 1940, Churchill becomes Prime Minister after the war started the previous year, in 1939. Churchill becomes Prime Minister, although he was a Liberal for 20 years around the time of World War I. Winston Churchill takes over as Prime Minister, and the war is it's called the Phoney War. It starts kicking along. And then on the 18th of June, just a month or so later, Winston Churchill does their finest hour speech, which we heard last week, about the future of Christian civilization, perverted science, amazing speech, really. And then literally a week later, the Duke Edward VIII, the Duke of Windsor, he was over in Spain, and he talks to the German diplomats there, and he tells them, you need to bomb Britain in order to get them to the negotiating table. So, unbelievably, Edward VIII is the person who's responsible for triggering the beginning of the bombing of Britain on the 25th of June, 1940. So we're going to continue this timeline after we've heard a clip from Karina Urbach talking about her book, Go-Betweens for Hitler. And she starts off by talking a bit about Charlie Coburg. But obviously the main subject of her discussion here for a couple of minutes is Edward VIII.
Charlie Kobuk puts pressure on them. He is a back channel to them, but he's also playing both sides because he's still a back channel to the other men. He still works with the Duke of Windsor. He still organizes the Duke of Windsor's trip to Germany. He makes sure that the Duke of Windsor meets Hitler, and he plays both kings, really. He's very clever about that. And that the Duke of Windsor was guilty, I think we can all agree on. I was very lucky because one of the quotes I found in the Franco papers that had been overlooked up till then shows absolutely convincingly that the Duke of Windsor was a traitor to his own country. The quote is interesting because he was talking to a Spanish diplomat, a friend of his, who immediately reported all of these conversations to Franco. And he says to the Spanish diplomat, on 25th of June 1940, the war is on, you know, Churchill is in power. But he says to him, if the Germans bomb England effectively, this could bring peace. The Duke of Windsor seems very much to hope that this would occur. He wants peace at any price. And he also criticizes Churchill and the British government. And the Bermejillo reports to Franco, he throws all the blame on the Jews and the Reds and Eden with his people in the Foreign Office and other politicians, all of whom he would have liked to put up against the wall. So I think he's pretty guilty. And if you say that your own country should be bombed, I think that is quite convincingly showing he's guilty. But I was very lucky because I'm married to a Russianist, and he got me another nice quote because I can't read Russian. I could do the Spanish, but I couldn't do the Russian. And he got me a wonderful quote that he found in the intelligence paper, in the Russian intelligence papers, which also shows how guilty the Duke of Windsor was. And that was a report that came to the Kremlin, a memo saying the former King of England, Edward, together with his wife Simpson, is at present in Madrid, where he is in touch with Hitler. Edward is conducting negotiations with Hitler on the question of the formation of a new English government and the conclusion of peace with Germany, contingent on a military alliance against the USSR.
So there he is, Martin, bang to rights, I suppose you could say. He's starting to try and form a new government, a fascist government for Britain, even whilst, and it's not really so surprising that they had to whisk Edward VIII away, is it?
No, and of course, this is high politics, unlike Meghan Markle and all the rest of it. This is serious. And of course, the Queen Mother was on the record in the 1930s of being very pro Hitler. None of that was mentioned at her funeral, was it?
Well, yes, apparently she was very pro-appeasement. But then, of course, when the war actually broke out, the Queen Mum absolutely got behind it. So, you know, the thing is, the difference here is that Edward VIII was on the Nazi side, you know, right the way from the beginning of the war, the build-up to the war, and actually during and through the war. That's the big difference. And I think, you know, when war breaks out, one can, you know, you can be excused for, you know, being whatever, pro-Nazi in trying to do a deal to stop a war. But once it breaks out, then you can't, definitely not. But anyway, so after that, that we just heard there, which was the 25th of June, Edward VIII, Duke of Windsor, asking the Nazi ambassador to bomb Britain into the negotiating table. Then we had just literally the next day, on the 26th of June, was the opening shots of the Battle of Britain, which were mine laying and reconnaissance flights fired by the Luftwaffe, literally the next day. And within about another 3 weeks, the 17th of July, the Luftwaffe started bombing the ports of Britain. The 13th of August 1940 was a big campaign to bomb the airfields. And this was obviously the Battle of Britain going on here. The idea is to try and get air superiority. If you could take the airfields out, then obviously the British weren't going to get their aircraft into the air. 18th of August, the Duke of Windsor then was then very much removed from the situation. And I do wonder whether the British knew exactly what he'd been saying down in Spain or in Lisbon or wherever he was, and decided that they were going to get him over to the Bahamas. That's 2 months after his statement about bombing Britain to the negotiating table. Then on the 7th of September 1940, was the beginning of the Blitz bombing campaign. Now, that led over the period of about 8 months to 42,000 British civilians being killed and 120,000 injured over 8 months. Of course, this does pale into insignificance when you look at the casualties on the Eastern Front, and with the Russians, when they started to they were betrayed, you know, with the Hitler-Stalin pact being betrayed. On the 24th of November 1940, Bristol city centre was bombed in this campaign. Thank you very much, Edward VIII. And the old Dutch house was destroyed, and Castle Park itself actually used to be a network of roads and lanes. That was burnt to the ground. The only thing that pretty much remains there is St. Peter's Church as a memorial to the Blitz in the Second World War in Castle Park. And also Temple Church, which is on Union Street, or just off Union Street in between Bristol Bridge and Bristol Temple Meads. That was also burnt out on the 24th of November. 2nd of December, we had Portland Square bombed here in St. Paul's. And I'm glad to see that after all this time, finally, 130 years or so later, isn't it? 120 years, that actual building that was bombed on the night of the 2nd of December 1940, part of Portland Square here, is being finally rebuilt by some developers who are also building a whole load of student accommodation, which is rather irritating. But anyway, and then on the 11th of May 1941, there was the end of this battle, with the air superiority being most definitely, I mean, basically the Luftwaffe had lost and they had to retreat because they were losing so many aircraft in the Blitz bombing campaign. So that was just about a year of bombing that went on as a result of Edward VIII and his encouragement of the Nazis to bomb Britain to the negotiating table, Martin.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Obviously, I don't suppose that the Germans actually, they were obviously quite happy to have him on side, but it's debatable whether they made their decisions according to his recommendations. And even if they did make his decisions according to his recommendations, I would argue that they were wrong. If the Luftwaffe had concentrated on the RAF bases instead of bombing London and Bristol, etc., they might have won. By switching to bombing civilians in cities, although it was much more destructive and caused more damage, that was, to my mind, a totally strategic error by the Germans.
Well, I mean, you say that, but they did indeed start bombing airfields on the 13th of August. They had a very concerted campaign in 1940, just after all this happened. And let's not forget that these raids started the day after this comment in Portugal, in Lisbon. This bombing of airfields, Martin, what happened is the Brits had quite a lot of airfields already built by this point. And what was happening is the Germans were bombing the airfields, and we had prior warning of them coming. So we were getting a lot of aircraft into the air, number one. And number two, we were bringing aircraft back away from their bombing ranges and things like that, so that we just had basically too many airfields and too many facilities for them to bomb. And they realized, I suppose, that if they were just focused on bombing the airfields, the aircraft were just going to be flying around and going somewhere else, that we were able to get our aircraft in the air so that they wouldn't themselves be destroyed.
Well, that's true. But I still think the idea that by bombing the cities, I mean, don't forget, everybody was terrified of the idea of aerial bombardment of civilian population. And it was thought on both sides that morale would collapse, governments would fall, you know, people would demand peace feelers and so on. We now know, you know, from the bombing of North Vietnam and so on subsequently, that in actual fact, aerial bombardment very rarely breaks the civilian population's will to resist one way or the other. And of course, what the other thing that they did by doing that is it gave Bomber Harris and the RAF carte blanche to incinerate hundreds of thousands of German civilians on the principle that if you can do it to us, we can do it to you. And of course, what's actually happening here is the degradation of humanity, ultimately ending up in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, which is another question in itself, isn't it? Because a lot of people have pointed out that those two nuclear bombs never needed really to be dropped. There was no justification for it. That effectively what it was really a live test.
Yes, and of course it was a demonstration to the Russians who were getting ready to invade Japan. You know, the way it was spun in my childhood was the nuclear bombs stopped us having to invade Japan, which would have been a bloodbath, and we didn't want a bloodbath. They gave in because we bombed Japan, bombed with nuclear weapons. But the Russians had swept through Manchuria, and they were quite prepared to take the casualties to conquer Japan. They'd already taken massive casualties. They were, you know, as Stalin said, we've got loads of people. And if that had happened, of course, the Russians would have ended up in control of Japan. And that's had to be stopped, and that's what that did.
And we have a longer interview with the former Syrian ambassador, Peter Ford, which I will put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, in which he talks a bit, Martin, about this whole idea of spin, really, where when you want to do something which no one is going to support, it's actually a fairly simple thing to just spin a line. And so long as you don't have any journalists questioning it, this will just go out to the public and at least initially be accepted.
Yeah, well, all wars begin as propaganda. And, you know, the truth is so important, because if people have an erroneous understanding of the way the world works, they can be manipulated. And, of course, obviously what we're trying to do week in, week out with this show is to make people think about what they think they know and to go and check it for themselves. You know, you shouldn't just listen to us talking.
I agree. Yeah, and also whether or not there's a long-term plan by any kind of secret society to control all religions and governments. This sort of thing is a possibility that needs properly examining and looking into, not just simply poo-pooing. The other idea is that, I'll also have a longer version of the interview I did down at Gloucester Road at the eviction. I'll put one of those up, a long version of that, if you're interested. And also the long version of the interview with Stanley Laham. I'll copy that up from last week as well. So it's time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest. That's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We also heard in the first part from Lib Dem councillor for Knoll, group leader on Bristol City Council, Gary Hopkins. And thanks also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Since Google and Yahoo manoeuvred me onto their email lists and then they banned both those lists, either for posts I couldn't moderate or for fake anti-Semitism claims, the only way to be included on my weekly email circulation list, I'm afraid now, is to email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. You'll find that address on the contact tab at thisweek.org.uk, and then you'll get an email hopefully every week of the show. At least, some of the main links, and if you want to follow up any stories. So if you a site or story you'd like to share, you think there's anything that I've missed or have a correction to make, please do reply to that weekly email. I'll make my own correction here, and that is earlier on I was talking about Archie being Meghan and Harry's daughter rather than his son, which is a pretty appalling mistake. Sorry about that. But anyway, if you have a correction, please do reply to the weekly email or just email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk, and do feel free to send links or scans or whatever you got. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics shows, podcast story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday lunch at Camberley's Radio Q UK.com. Thank you very much to Radio Q. Do please make recordings of the stream unless our MP3 platform is down, which it sometimes is at the weekends. Feel free to download and rebroadcast the show anywhere you like, and we'll list you here. But do credit us at thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.